It's Friday!
Okay! Tokyo!
South America!
Australia!
France!
Germany!
UK!
Africa!
Here we go! Head on with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy. One of my favorite days of the week, Friday, not because it's the end of the week, but because it means that we are all set for Friday on the front porch here on the Horn. This is the seventh day of February 2020. This is the Horn. HeadOn.live is where we live on the interweb tube. It's where you can go for your one-stop shop for all of your podcasting needs. It's where you can go if you'd like to be part of the merry, wacky, zany, real-time multimedia extravaganza that is the Horn chat room. In the 3 hours in which this program is live, wingnuts and shitheads not allowed. You will be lightsabered. You have been warned. But otherwise, just pick out a screen name and a password if you never have before and jump right in, and you will be greeted by the likes of Anatole and Faith Ann and House of Roberts and Jimmy and Squeaky and Terry and Saigon, all of whom are just itching to see you. And capably moderated by longtime inveterate, indefatigable veteran chat room moderator Sparky, who, being a third-stage guild navigator, has folded space to become Man Cave, because it's apparently a nice day for space folding in Northern California. Here in the hills and hollers of almost level West by Cold Trump, Virginia, Stan, and all over Central Appalachia, it's gotten right floody. If you go over to my Facebook page, you can see some what appears to be drone footage of flooding in eastern Kentucky, you know, where there used to be mountains to absorb the rain, but there aren't more, no. Because, you know, holy prophet, coal companies and the like, right? But today, ever so briefly, the rain turned to snow, and although I am eager to see the end of winter, I gotta say that the snow was kind of pretty to behold, so I toddled out in the four-wheel drive and got a couple of snapshots. You might enjoy them. They're also on my Facebook page, my Instagram. There's so much water, they opened the spillways at Hawk's Nest Dam, and the roar was more than audible 1,000 feet above the dam. Yeah, that's where it was pretty impressive. And the river, the second oldest river on Earth, the oldest river in this hemisphere, It was a roaring beast when the Amazon and the Mississippi were barely creeks, if at all. Well, the new river looks like a flowing river of hot chocolate because of all the Appalachia that it's carrying away and dumping into the Ohio and dumping into the Mississippi. And well, eventually, it comes to rest, some of it, there at the mouth of the Mississippi River. On the Gulf Coast, and if nature had been left to its own devices instead of drilling and prospecting and modifying the bejesus out of the Mississippi Delta, there'd still be a lot more Louisiana than there used to be. There'd still be a lot more Louisiana than there is now. That's what I meant to say. But it was pretty outside. It was very pretty. Nice to get out. Kind of downright cold. But I guess tomorrow, no more snow. And then Just back to cold and gray and shitty. And that's pretty much the definition of February, when, remember, the Romans wanted us to take stock and atone for our atone for the sins of the past years by holding barbecues and offering it to God, and then when God didn't want any, eating it ourselves. Not a terrible plan, and, you know, hiding it under the fig leaf of religion, well, cool. Yeah, barbecued chicken, barbecued pork pig, barbecued beef, ox roast, yum. Oh, hi, I'm Bob, and every program here at the Horn begins with gratitude, this program being no different. Let's check in and make sure we thank our subscribers. Thank the subscribers for help keeping us on the air. Our subscribers for the seventh day of the month. Thank you to Reed. Thank you to James in Illinois. Thank you to Brock. And thank you to Dr. Allen down in Texas. Thank you all so very kindly for being part of the merry little band that month to month as subscribers helps keep things going. And thanks to all of our a la carte contributors as well. Sadly, Chris's challenge last night failed. It failed by about $50. The fundraising goal for this evening, taking into account what we did bring in last night, fundraising goal for this evening is at $510, and that'll finish the week. And maybe then I can order the new computer. So to get the stream back to where it needs to be, and I can actually see the monitor without breaking my freaking neck to turn. Never mind. It's a small, small space here. But that's where we are, $510. And, you know, when you crawl over $500, we're talking about a community-made miracle. Those things do happen. And so here in about a little less than an hour, we will I'll wander over to the old holler tree we sublet from the Keebler Elves, wherein resides the Extraordinary Ordinary Roundtable, around which gathers the participants in the aforementioned Extraordinary Ordinary Roundtable. And we'll see what's on folks' minds. For now, I just kind of wanted to get out of Washington for a little bit and feel a little less skeevy, as it were. And there's a bunch of stories that allow us to do that. How about Arizona? How about Arizona? Gosh, I'm sorry this isn't just terribly, terribly, terribly happy news, but, it is what it is. Now, you know that this program and I on this program have devoted more time than any other broadcaster on planet Earth, more time than any other broadcaster in history, to discussing the horrors of mountaintop removal. And in particular, over the last 10 years or so, we have talked about the health impacts of the horrors of mountaintop removal that come with the dust that follows in the wake of massive blasting required to take down a mountain. It takes a lot to destroy a mountain. Well, like I said, let's go to Arizona. In particular, southern Arizona, and a national monument there. Last night, of course, we talked about the fact that Utah is now going to be punished for Bishop Willard Romney's decision to stand up for his oath to the Constitution as opposed to participating in the cult of personality that surrounds the Flaccid Flavius, the occupant of the White House. Well, I guess you could probably say the same thing for Arizona, where Kristen Sinema got her vote right and honored the Constitution as well. I go back to what I said about, or that quote that I mentioned from the late, great Hunter S. Thompson. The hogs are in the tunnel, and they will travel on a road of bones. And so, what we're talking about here is Organ Pipe Cactus National Monument. It's in the Sonoran Desert of southern Arizona. It is said to be a magnificent place. It has been known for a very long time as a tremendous addition to our national heritage and our ecological future. It is wilderness in every sense of the word. Among other things, it's also deeply sacred for a number of indigenous peoples in the region. Well, no matter. No matter at all. Because the regime of venereal Vespasian has decided to blow it up. It's a mountainous region. I'm not sure if it's part of the Sierra Madre Oriental or the Sierra Madre Occidental, but there's mountains there. And some of those mountains are, even as we speak, being blown to kingdom come with the same kind of blasting technology that they've used for well over two decades here in Appalachia. Vast clouds of toxic dust wafting through the area. I don't know where the nearest downwind community is, but wherever it is, they're probably getting dusted, as it were. And according to Customs and Border Protection, you know, the thugs, A contractor is going to spend the rest of the month of February blowing the living bejesus out of mountains within the Roosevelt Reservation at Monument Mountain Complex in the Tucson sector of the Border Patrol. It's called Monument Hill. In the Orwellian language of a press statement from Border Patrol. The controlled blasting is targeted and will continue intermittently for the rest of the month. We will continue to have an environmental monitor present during these activities, as well as ongoing clearing activities. Yeah. And the environmental monitor, if the environmental monitor sees anything going on, the environmental monitor can fuck right the fuck off, because it won't matter. And seeing as how the government of the United States, Democrat or Republican, does not have a standard at the Environmental Protection Agency for ultra-fine particulate matter, that won't matter either. You might note that the EPA only has standards for PM10 and particulate matter, PM10 and PM2.5. They don't have a standard for particulate matter any smaller than that, which is worrisome. Because, among other things, we're finding out now through research over at Virginia Polytechnic Institute, VPI, Virginia Tech, not too far from here over in Blacksburg, Virginia, the same institution that was paid a gajillion dollars by the coal industry to try to disprove the health data about mountaintop removal and failed. Well, another segment of Virginia Tech is apparently not quite so venal and nasty. Because they've made a rather stunning discovery, and I'll explain why it's stunning. A professor with the Virginia Maryland College of Veterinary Medicine by the name of Irving Coy Allen, working alongside folks from Virginia Tech and the University of Colorado and the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, East Carolina University, and East China Normal University in Shanghai, have published the results of some work that they did in a scientific journal called Frontiers in Immunology. Now, they don't publish stuff at Frontiers in Immunology that isn't peer-reviewed, that hasn't been rigorously checked out by other scientists to make sure the methodology and the conclusions are legit. Well, they're legit, and what they've discovered is that when you burn coal, the nanoparticles, see also ultrafines, you know, a particle of less than 1/100th the diameter of a human hair, the nanoparticles produced after 6 weeks of exposure, long-term damage ensues. Now, take that and extrapolate that to the gajillion tons of coal that we still burn in this country, and you get a pretty good idea why we have some of the disease rates we do and why they're ever so much higher when they are near to a coal-fired power plant. What's the culprit? Well, the culprit is a nanoparticle called titanium oxide. Oh, the things we hillbillies have had to learn about in the last 20 years. Titanium oxide. It's a byproduct of burning coal. Here's the funny thing about titanium oxide, though. When it is in larger particulate form, and I just went, what? And my pink little ears perked right up when I read this article. Because I remembered years ago toddling around the state of Wisconsin with my dear friend Dr. Michael McCauley, who had joined me up there to give warnings about the particulate, the dangers of ultrafine particulates. From, among other things, blasting when there was a plan going forward by a nasty old now-dead coal magnate from West Virginia by the name of Michael Klein. And, oh, damn it. Frontier got me, bastards. We're back now. Sparky in the chat room, what the fuck happened to the stream, all caps, rerun playing. Well, Sparky, what happens is when the stream collapses here, a rerun begins playing on headon.live so that everything doesn't just fall all to pieces. But now we're back. Anyway, that titanium oxide, it just happened in conversation that Dr. McCauley explained to me that titanium oxide is often used for experimental purposes. For experimental purposes, titanium oxide is used when scientists want to be able to test effects of particulate matter without having any negative effects, because in its larger particulate form, say PM2.5 or PM10, titanium oxide is utterly benign. It doesn't react with anything. It doesn't bond any. It causes no harm whatsoever. But he went on to tell me that he and a colleague had come to realize something. That even something like titanium oxide, when it's reduced to its nano form or its ultrafine form, becomes toxic as hell. And that's what this study confirms. And so was born a little slogan. I came up with it. I looked at Dr. McCauley and I said, so what you're telling me, he said, because what he said was that anything that becomes a nanoparticle, anything that becomes an ultrafine, becomes toxic. Because at that size, it becomes able to do massive harm inside the cellular and subcellular level structures of the human body and any other living bodies as well, cells as cells. And so we developed a slogan. There's no benign ultrafine. Anything reduced to... And it has long-term consequences, because once upon a time, the great hope of science was that big, wonderful, magical things were going to happen with nanotechnology. The only problem being that when you get something down to nanotechnology... it becomes toxic. And what happens to the cells exposed to the titanium oxide nanoparticles? Well, Dr. Allen said they can't break the titanium nanoparticles down, so the cells begin to die, and this process recruits more microphages. These processes begin a feedback loop with each round of dying cells concentrating around the nanoparticles. The dying nanoparticle-containing cells then begin to make deposits in the lungs, and these deposits cause problems. We begin seeing negative impacts on lung function, and basically the lungs fail to continue to work correctly. This has tremendous ramifications for, say, cities with a lot of air pollution, especially in light of the fact that, like most of the science they don't believe in, this gang of thugs in the White House doesn't think air pollution exists either. They think if they can't see smog, smog must not be there. But we've known here in Appalachia and preached for long and long that what you can't see can kill you. Among other things, they noted, the scientists did, we realized if someone is living near a power plant or near one of these coal-burning sources, they wouldn't be exposed to a single dose, they'd be exposed to this daily. We also didn't see lung clearance after a week, so when these things are in your lungs, they're staying there, and they're staying there for an extended period of time. And then damaged lungs are more susceptible to bacterial or viral infection. Hi, I'm Bob Kincaid. Little ray of fucking sunshine. But hey, at least we're not talking about Trump directly, right? Right. And the sad thing is, this is one of those things that both parties get wrong. And when they get it wrong, they start talking about the way they get it wrong is by talking about things like, well, you know, it might have a negative impact on the economy. Funny how they never talk about people dying miserably has a negative impact on the economy. Because when they say the economy, what they really mean is wealthy people. So that's part and parcel of it all. And it's something to think about. Another fine, fine reason not to burn coal. Really good reason. And interestingly, here in West Virginia, our Republican-controlled legislature just introduced a bill making it illegal to shut down coal-fired power plants. Doesn't matter if frack gas, which is also toxic as hell and sufficient to cook the planet, or to cook the planet's ability to support human life, which is a different and more important thing, even if it's economically smart to retire a coal-fired power plant and replace it with something cheaper to the power producer. No. The West Virginia legislature, in its Republican non-wisdom, It says it's going to wants to make it illegal to shut down a coal-fired power plant. And, you know, something just tells me that the people who purchase the electricity from the provider will wind up being the ones who pay the bills to economically prop up these failing antiquated technology boondoggles. Because, of course, we will. Now, I had a note from Steve in New York. Let's kick off our Friday on the Front Porch Merkel with a $10 challenge. So that would be wonderful, and that would get us below the $500 mark to finish the week. So perfect. That would get us down to $490. If somebody's got 10 bucks to match up with Steve's 10, that'll get us rolling. Thank you, Steve. Thank you very much. Lady B, with a brief piece of correspondence, a visual for me. Yes, the snow in the Springs. That's a little more snow than we got. We could still kind of drive and get around. Darlene in Connecticut said, "Hoo-wee, have we got some weather in the upper elevations of Connecticut?" Second photo shows the best backyard in my town, mine. LOL, most particularly in the summertime. Thank goodness for your show in the Horn community, Bob, which warms the cockles of my heart on an early evening like this. You know what? You can't, there's nothing better than happy cockles. Warm cockles. And so that is, what I'm looking at now is Darlene's backyard. Is that some sort of fruit tree back there, Darlene? Is there some sort of sweet and fruity wonderfulness that happens on that in the summer? Sorry, Flavio, I can't go back and explain the burning of coal and nanoparticles. I know you got cut off, but daggummit, it's just about, well, it'd stop being a program if I had to repeat everything that I said when Frontier fucks up. Kevin says, assuming you know by now, but both the tune-in and head-on live streams are down. That was 1 minute ago? No, they're back up. And, of course, I could say, Kevin, you need to reload your browser, but Kevin can't hear me. Technology. I love it. So, Arizona, Virginia. Sooner or later, we're going to find our way back to Washington, D.C., aren't we? It's unavoidable. We've managed to get it up all the way to 64 degrees here in the fabulous Horn Studios at the magnificent Kincaid Mansion. So I can back the propane consumption down a little bit. Now, because I'm getting emails from various places, and I've seen a comment from Faith Ann in the chat room. I'm just absolutely sick about Lieutenant Colonel Vindman, beyond sick. Ugh. And what Faith Ann's talking about, and what Jamie's talking about. Is the fact that Lieutenant Colonel Vindman, who honored the oath that he took to the Constitution of the United States by telling the truth when he was asked to speak the truth about the Ukraine filth. He had previously said that he was going to knock off early from his position on the National Security Council staff. But that wasn't good enough, because now, in the terror, which grips Washington, D.C., and finds Nitwit Nero exacting revenge wherever he can find a place to exact it. Well, today, Lieutenant Colonel Vindman... Oh, for pity's sakes. Today, Lieutenant Colonel Vindman was unceremoniously fired and was escorted out of the White House under guard. It's disgusting. It's unpresidential, and it is entirely predictable. Now, thanks to people like Marsha Gedney Blackburn, he is he's getting death threats and has had to be moved to a secure, undisclosed location. It's pathetic. But that, of course, is how fascists roll. And it's to be expected, I suppose. Ambassador David Pressman said, "There is no question in the mind of any American why this man's job is over, why this country now has one less soldier serving it." At the White House, Lieutenant Colonel Vindman was asked to leave for telling the truth. His honor, his commitment to right, frightened the powerful. The truth has cost Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman his job, his career, and his privacy. He did what any member of our military is charged with doing every day. He followed orders, he obeyed his oath, and he served his country, even when doing so was fraught with danger and personal peril. Ambassador Pressman is the lawyer for Lieutenant Colonel Vindman. And let's take a moment. You know, that whole compare and contrast thing comes in handy so often. Let's compare and contrast Lieutenant Colonel Vindman with, say, Marine General James Mattis, first Secretary of Defense under Donald Trump, who allegedly tried to stop some of the worst impulses that gripped the dribbling shreds of Trump's brain. But when it came time to be a patriot, when it came time to speak up, he just quit. He resigned and wrote a fucking book to try to make a little scratch. And in the course of that book tour, and perhaps in that book, he said something to the effect of, "Well, I think the president is entitled for a while to my silence." How long, General? How long, old blood and guts? How long, old Semper Fi? How long will you keep your silence? When a man like Lieutenant Colonel Vindman has to teach you, the former Commandant of the United States Marine Corps, the meaning of honor, the meaning of duty, the meaning of integrity. "Well, the check cleared, see, and I got plans for another book." Could be part of the trouble with our country is the people who value checks clearing from book deals more than they do things like oaths to the Constitution. Which kind of loops back around to Bishop Willard Romney. And this is kind of the long historical, you know, wide-angle lens view of it. But you have to remember the cultural time period in which Mormonism arises. First of all, upstate New York was a hotbed of activity in terms of alternative philosophies and alternative ways of viewing the world. And Joseph Smith had tried several of them. You remember in Life of Brian, the John Cleese character who tells Brian, "Oh, you're the Messiah, and I should know, I've followed a few." Well, upstate New York, where Mormonism was born, was kind of like that. There was a visionary or a philosopher or a prophet on every corner. And everybody had and it seemed like everybody had a side hustle in that way. This is at the same period of time when, as the colonists pressed across the Midwest and Southeast and westward toward the Mississippi and so forth, and they would see the vast pyramidal cities built by the ancient indigenous people, they couldn't conceive of the idea that Indians, as they called them, had built them, or the ancestors of the Indians had built them. No. They decided that those mounds, by God, they were just mounds. They're not pyramids. They're just piles of dirt. Those mounds had been built by the lost tribes of the children of Israel. No shit. And so that is swept around the country. And people were all the time stumbling on stuff that had been created by the lost tribes of the children of Israel. And among other things, when in the early 1800s, when Thomas Jefferson, the slave raper, when Thomas Jefferson sent the Lewis and Clark Corps of Discovery out, he specifically instructed them to find out if it was true that one of those Indian tribes way the hell up the Missouri River was actually descended from Welshmen, because another thing that was, this country was aflame with crazy bullshit conspiracy theories. Is. Only instead of, because, you know, they really weren't looking up into space that much, instead of blaming it on the amorphous, multi-limbed aliens from Norblap 9, they lost children of Israel, lost tribes of Welshmen. Right. And so Joseph Smith, it comes up with this thing, rather than use a less charitable term, where he started telling people that he took a pair of rocks and looked into a hat with the rocks, and by putting some gold plates inside the hat and looking at the gold plates through the rocks in the hat, and thus was born the Book of Mormon. And he was given the prophetic ability to translate it from something into English from something called Reformed Egyptian. Now, suffice to say that there is not a linguist or philologist on this planet who actually has real expertise who will tell you that such a thing as Reformed Egyptian exists. There isn't and never was something called Reformed Egyptian. at all. Looks like we're going to have a fun evening with Frontier. I just blinked, buffered up and knocked out again, but thanks to Dave and Brother Deacon Asa, we got it back on tooth sweet. And now that the stream is back up, let me explain again that what happens on HeadOn.live is when the stream buffers up and quits here, the server at HeadOn.live immediately begins playing an older program so that the stream isn't interrupted. So that's why the other show kicks in when I kick out. But back to the broad view of Bishop Willard and his oath. The other thing that was really, really big in the young United States at the time of the founding of Mormonism was Masonry. You know, the Masonic Lodge. George Washington, famously, was a Mason. And the Masons have had tremendous influence on organizational structures in this country. The fraternity that I belong to was founded by six young Masons at Jefferson College in Washington, PA. I'm sorry, not Washington, PA. Canonsburg, PA. And the Masons are all about ritual, and they got high signs and low signs and secret handshakes and magic words and special garments and things that they say to each other. And to give it the term is secret society. And this was the environment in which Mormonism formed. And so Mormonism itself is full of ordinances. And those ordinances are structured very much like the 19th century mania for secret societies, hence things like the magic underwear. But there's oath-taking involved. Now, I was raised in the Southern Baptist Church, and I don't recall having to take any oaths to be a Baptist. I don't recall anybody I knew who was Methodist having to take any oaths to be a Methodist, And the rest of the more mainline Protestant sects that more closely split off from Catholicism, you know, they still, you know, the closest they get is repeating the Apostolic Creed every so often. But no oaths. There's oath-taking, if I understand correctly. In Mormonism. And to be an oath breaker, well, if you'll break, and this is why it mattered. You know, and yesterday we talked about how Precious Lindsay said, "I think his religion has clouded his thinking." Well, in light of the fact that Mormons aren't able to drink hot drinks and are to eschew things like caffeine and can't drink booze, I'm hard-pressed to figure out how his reason got clouded. The only thing that clouded Bishop Willard's reason is the notion that is held fairly fairly closely in that faith system, is that if a person will break one oath, they'll break them all. Because oaths either mean something or they do not. And in the case of 52 Republican senators on Wednesday, the answer is they matter not. An oath is just something that you mumble and then go on about your business. But for some people, to swear an oath is to be bound by it. And indecent people who would break an oath do not understand why the breaking of one is such a grave, grave thing. And so when the Republicans criticize Bishop Willard Romney, what they're actually doing is exposing their own perfidy. And for instance, in Dante's Inferno, the ninth level of hell, the very worst you can get, the place where the torment is the worst that hell has to offer. That ninth circle is reserved for the oath breakers, for the traitors, for the betrayers, for those who engage in treachery. In Dante's vision, one of the principal occupants of that ninth circle is Judas. Judas Iscariot top, or Iscariot. And he uses some Renaissance era oath breakers as well. Well, that apparently matters to Bishop Willard Romney. It apparently does not matter to people like Susan Collins and Precious Lindsay. Of course, then again, Precious Lindsay comes from a state where oath-breaking is a long and dishonorable tradition. It was oath-breaking, of course, that led to the conflagration in 1861 that took the lives of 400 Americans and 300 traitors. And so we have here an example of two people who refused to break their oaths. and of far too many who were willing to shit on theirs. Lieutenant Colonel Vindman held his oath higher than any allegiance to any single human being. And the same may be said for Bishop Willard Romney. And as odd as it is to say it, may also be said of Joe Manchin. It may be said of every Democrat who voted to impeach, to convict, that their oaths, too, held more sway for them than allegiance to a single corpulent, corrupt, crooked, perverted, drug-addled individual. And that's what got Lieutenant Colonel Vindman fired. Let's see, in the rank structure, it goes Lieutenant Colonel, full bird colonel, general. All Lieutenant Colonel Vindman had to do was lie for the president. That's all. And he probably would have been a bird colonel by now on the personal order of Tangerine Tiberius. Fast-tracked to becoming a general and getting that star on his shoulder boards. Now, though, it's an open question as to whether he has a career at all. But he'll be going back to the Pentagon. Or maybe, depending on just how vindictive Nitwit Nero is, maybe he'll be specially assigned. You know, if Nitwit Nero can bring a sergeant home from Afghanistan to turn him into a set-piece stage prop for his reality show, reality TV game show of a State of the Union, he can also disappear a man into a forgotten legion. I don't know what comes next for Lieutenant Colonel Vindman. It has been said that of commissioned officers, when you run up against something that goes contrary to your values and your oath, that you don't complain. You certainly don't disobey. You resign your commission. And that is supposed to be sufficient to telegraph to the world what you otherwise would not say. So hopefully that puts the whole business of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman, who is not a Mormon that I know of, and Bishop Willard Romney, who is, in context. It's all about the oaths. And the degree to which one either honors or dishonors them. Steve in New York says, lying for Trump, Lieutenant Colonel Vindman didn't even have to lie for it. He could have just kept quiet. That's all. Well, that's a sin of omission. And there's still a bunch of other stuff to talk about this evening. And of course, when we go over to the Extraordinary Ordinary Roundtable, we'll find out what's on folks' mind there. Steve from New York got us started with a $10 challenge on $510 that we need to raise to finish the week here. And so thus far, it is unresponded to 55 minutes into the program. Hopefully, we will knock it down. Hopefully. our buddy Ronan in DeFrozenburg was going to put up a challenge, but at the I got a note from him saying, scratch it. I have to take one of my cats to the emergency hospital because she's having a bad seizure. Sorry. No apologies necessary at all, Rico. Thank you, Rico, very kindly for even being willing. And I hope your kitty cat's okay. Note coming in from Mike in Cascadia. Trump and federal public lands. From Anwar to the Boundary Waters Wilderness to Bears Ears and Grand Staircase Escalante National Monuments to Oregon Pipe Cactus National Monument, the Trump regime is plowing full steam ahead with destroying some of our federal prized federal public lands. They cruelly say they're opening up federal public land at a record pace. They don't mention that opening means giving it all away to oil and coal and timber and motorized recreation. All that federal public land is our land. I see many comments, including the feds don't need all that land or let the locals manage that land since they know the land and know what's best for it. Wow, that one always gives me a giggle, because if that's the case, you just turn it over to the indigenous people who managed it very effectively for 10,000 years and say, y'all manage it. But anyway, Mike in Cascadia says, if that wisdom had prevailed back in the 1870s, Yellowstone National Park would never have been Yellowstone National Park, since the locals in Bozeman back then were lobbying President Grant to not designate Yellowstone as a park. Those locals in Bozeman back then, well, they saw profits from the place, not a park for all the people. Imagine what we would have lost if that short-sighted vision then had prevailed. Now, that short-sighted vision is the GOP national platform. Their platform includes the disposal of federal public land. Disposal means privatization. We the people own 640 million acres across the country. It's ours. It'll be a tragedy if we lose our land in all special and sacred places. Back in the 1960s, David Brower and the Sierra Club rallied the public to stop the federal government from building dams in the Grand Canyon. Where are those voices today, and where is that movement today? If you've never read Wallace Stegner's The Wilderness Letter, I would recommend it. Here are a few of his words. Something will have gone out of us as a people if we ever let the remaining wilderness be destroyed, if we permit the last virgin forest to be turned into comic books and plastic cigarette cases. If we drive the few remaining members of the wild species into zoos or to extinction, if we pollute the last clear air and dirty the last clean streams and push our paved roads through the last of the silence so that never again will Americans be free in their own country from the noise, the exhaust, the stinks of human and automotive waste, and so that never again can we have the chance to see ourselves single, separate, vertical, and individual in the world, part of the environment of trees and rocks and soil, brother to the other animals, part of the natural world and competent to belong in it. Without any remaining wilderness, we are committed wholly, without chance for even momentary reflection and rest, to a headlong drive into our technological termite life, the brave new world of a completely man-controlled environment. We need wilderness preserved, as much of it as still left, and as many kinds, because it was the challenge against which our character as a people was formed. The reminder and the reassurance that it is still there is good for our spiritual health, even if we never once in 10 years set foot in it. It is good for us when we are young because of the incomparable sanity it can bring briefly as vacation and rest into our insane lives. It is important to us when we are old simply because it is there. Important, that is, simply as an idea. I've read that quote in the past, and it formed part of what I think about when I think about noise. We live with noises that even 200 years ago were incomprehensible. The loudest thing back then was the blast of a cannon, or thereabouts. And we live with more noise on a daily basis than probably 99% or more of humanity has ever had to cope with, and it has an impact. And the ability to go into silence
is profound. Even if, like me, and I have a nasty case of tinnitus after all these years with these cans on my head. It's really weird to go into a silent space and have the loudest thing in my head be what's going on in my head. It's so strange to wander into the woods and notice the silence that comes in all around you. But then if you too will be silent in a little bit, the life comes back. The chattering of the squirrels, the tweeting of the birds, a distant step over dried leaves by a deer, perhaps. It all comes back. But in the case, for instance, of Grand Staircase and Bear's Ears in Utah, the desire for more profit that will do no one except the profiteers any great good trumps in every sense of the word the magnificence of unmolested nature. Thank you, Ralphs, for answering Steve in New York's challenge. That gets us going. Thank you so much. That gets us down to 490. Thank you, Ralphs. We badly need to finish this off this evening. Thank you so much. Steve in New York reminded me Lieutenant Colonel Vindman is Jewish. He's well acquainted with retribution. Indeed. Indeed. Flavio pointing out that Kyrsten Sinema is a Mormon too, if I'm not mistaken, or was. Yeah, I'm guessing that whole not a strictly straight heterosexual female thing kind of got her Mormon card pulled. You'll have that. So let's go over to the Extraordinary Ordinary Roundtable in the old holler tree we sublet from the Keebler Elves and check in with Sparky. Hey, Sparky.
Hey, Bob. Can you hear me?
I gotcha.
Oh, okay. Because I was out wandering around the back lot with the headphones on and just come back in. Checking out stuff with binoculars.
Apparently, you got pretty good range.
Well, now I'm back in the shop, sitting in the chair right by the open door.
Oh, I see.
Grady's out here chewing, laying in the sun, chewing on his chew stick.
Well, all labs have to have one of those.
Well, this is it looks like a bone, but it's just a chew stick, and they last for a long time. And anyway, I was watching magpies too. A group of them were here a little while ago. Did you happen to see that video that I posted on Facebook?
Yeah, about Trump at the prayer breakfast. Yes. From Lawrence O'Donnell.
Yeah, what do you think of it?
I thought it was, as is quite almost always the case with Lawrence, I thought it was entirely correct. And I thought pretty pithy too. I mean that was kind of a deep dive.
I enjoyed it.
Yeah, the idea that Trump is unfamiliar with the concept of love. Yeah, and of course you can say that about any psychopath and sociopath.
I think Steve must have went off the deep end with this thing.
What?
He's not around today. Steve from Georgetown.
Yeah, what? I know, but I heard went off the deep end with and then lost you.
Oh, with what's happening, you know how it gets.
Oh, well, yeah. I don't know. Maybe he and Miss Karen are out enjoying the weekend there in North Georgia. I prefer to hope that.
Okay. Or he just wants to get away from all the talk.
Well, that's a possibility, too. Because it's...
Sparky?
It's hard to watch.
Right.
Were you referring to that thing that Lawrence O'Donnell did about Trump not even communicating via rumor with the theology of Christ and the nature of love?
Last night, I posted the YouTube link in the chat.
See, I don't think that he goes to church anymore. He might have as a child or something.
Well, as a child, Scott, his parents were apparently at least passingly familiar devotees of Norman Vincent Peale.
Oh, yes. The power of positive thinking. I remember him. he was the Robert Schuller of his day, I think. As a matter of fact, Schuller pretty much lifted his bit about possibility thinking and stuff more or less directly from Norman Vincent Peale, who, by the way, was a big, in the 1960 election between Nixon and Kennedy, Kennedy being the first Catholic to seriously run for the presidency, I believe Norman Vincent Peale threw his support behind Nixon, who was a Protestant, a Quaker, I think his mother was anyway.
Yeah, he did.
Yeah, and I'm sure that he was one of the ministers that Nixon consulted with, along with Billy Graham, Dr. Graham Cracker.
It's the Jews, the Jews.
That's right. That's right, Dick. It's the Jews. Well, he told that to Kissinger.
Hey, Bob, when you were talking about the Masons, I had to remember that my dad was a Mason at one time.
I do like their jars. They're storage jars for cannons, for fruits. And sorry.
But when I was little before we moved here to Red Bluff, he was in the Willows Masonic Lodge, and my mother was part of Eastern Star.
Oh, yeah.
So,
Sparky, have you ever been the only thing
I was ever exposed to as a little kid, I guess.
Have you ever been to D.C., Washington, D.C.?
No. I've been to New York City, but I've never been to Washington, D.C.
I know Bob has, and every time he goes for the Coal Mountains lobbying effort, more or less every year, I encourage him to take a side trip over to Alexandria, Virginia, my hometown, and visit
I've never been to it, but I've been by it. It's a magnificent structure.
That George Washington Masonic Temple up on the hill?
Yeah.
Next time you're back there, you set aside part of an afternoon, if you can, and go take the tour and go up to the top and look at the view. We used to spend a lot of time there as kids, and especially in the winter when we'd get a good snow, that hill was the best place in town for sledding. And they were all, it's all very Masonic and spooky, I think, but that's just me.
No, it's a fascinating organization, and the degree of influence they had structurally is quite surprising if you study it, because of course it came over from merry old England along with the rest of British colonization.
Yeah, and George Washington, was his lodge. In other words, the building was only built in the 1920s, but it was handed uh, the the property, I think, was owned by the Masons who ran the lodge that George Washington was a member of. And there's stuff on display in their little museum, you know, his George Washington's Masonic apron and his trowel and various bric-a-brac.
Yeah, his fedora, things like that.
I got my dad's apron somewhere. I had it once upon a time.
Well, my see, there's two rites. There's the York Rite and the Scottish Rite. And, you know, it's not like they go to war or anything, but, you know, there's subtle differences, I suppose. And it's all, you know, I don't, it astonishes me to know that there are still people in this country go, ooh, Masonic demonology, goddamn. But then again, we live in a country where, did you catch this one? I mean, this one just went through me like a dose of salt. 4-year-old child with the flu having seizures. The doctor prescribed and told mama to give baby Tamiflu. Okay?
Yeah. I saw that. Jesus.
Instead, she went on Facebook, and Facebook still allows this group to exist. She went on Facebook and checked in to get some advice from her anti-vaxxer group. And they told her, don't give that child Tamiflu. It might cause autism. Instead, put potatoes in your baby's socks. That's great for flu. And the child died. And the child died.
And, you know, they were, I forget what show it was. One show this morning was talking about the guy that runs that site, that anti-vaxxer site. He apparently doesn't have kids. His sole purpose is to use the site to sell books and videos, you know, concerning the anti.
Yeah, he's an anti-vaxxer, Alex Jones.
Yeah, yeah. And Facebook, I mean, they must really love the money that these disreputable sites that are allowed on there, not just the political disinformation and misinformation. I mean, that's bad enough. But stuff that starts affecting people's health and well-being, it's inconscionable or unconscionable. It's one of those.
And the fact that, you know, these parents who, under almost any other circumstances, would be guilty of felony abuse or felony abuse and neglect of a child, will probably go untouched, this mother. Because, you know, we got rights in this country, and we got ourselves a First Amendment and stuff, and if you want to put potatoes, if you want to put potatoes in the child's socks when the child's got the flu and the child dies, well, that's just freedom.
See, I had no idea that that was a homespun, nonsensical flu remedy. I would think potatoes having eyes, it would have something to do with your vision, you know?
No, that's carrots, damn it.
Oh, sorry, Bugs Bunny never wore corrective lenses, you know? He knew enough to take a ride at Albuquerque, I'll tell you that right now. Jesus.
He did wear glasses once in a while in costumes and stuff.
Yeah. And speaking of Masons, Mel Blanc was a big Mason, was real big in the supporting and the fundraising for the... now, that is one thing that the Masons do that I applaud. All over the country, maybe even the world, they have burn hospitals for children that are badly injured in fires and stuff. They do that, and I think they should be applauded for
that's
that.
That's the Shriners.
I thought, well, those are the Masons. I mean, that's what I know that the George Washington Masonic group are considering themselves Shriners, and that's one of their fundraising outreaches.
Yeah, the Shriners are the next step up after Masonry. You've got to go all the way through the rite, all the way through all the degrees, and then you can get into the shrine.
Yeah, what's the highest? It's like 33 and a third or something?
33, yeah. 33 degrees.
Jesus. Harry Truman was a Mason. There are a lot of famous, you look it up. I'm sure there's a web page.
And by the way, this will be galling to folks like Kevin and Lady B. The woman who killed her son with potatoes in his socks, that didn't come out quite right. Anyway, the anti-vaxxer freak was in Colorado.
Well, and I'll bet you $10 that she was a religious fanatic to boot, on top of it all.
Well, the reporting that we have says that she said, she wrote on the Facebook group, the doc prescribed Tamiflu. I did not pick it up. And now the family's fundraising off of it.
What I'm getting is a lot
and
of
not,
these
and she are... got and she got 45 comments on her Facebook post, the mother did, and not one of them said, for Christ's sakes, get the child to the hospital.
Well, no.
The natural cures I'm using on all four of my children aren't working. I mean, I'm using peppermint oil, vitamin C, and lavender, and it's not working. So then the anti-vaxxer group got together and said, why don't you try breast milk? You know, you might want to try some thyme and some elderberry. She wrote back, perfect, I'll try that.
Yeah, I would be very surprised if she was not also a religious fanatic, because all those crazies buy into the notion that there's some nobility in suffering, which is the biggest load of crap that there ever was. Like, there's some, you get extra brownie points with God if you suffer.
Meanwhile, they reached out to Facebook, and a spokescreep at Facebook said, oh, this is a tragedy, and our thoughts are with his family and loved ones. We don't want vaccine misinformation on Facebook, which is why we're working hard to reduce it everywhere on the platform, including in private groups. And yet it was still up. Meanwhile, at the Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment, the little preschooler, they had no record whatsoever that the child had ever been vaccinated. Yeah. And Brother Deacon Asa with a note. Where'd it go? Well, that said you'd be surprised how many lefties are anti-vaxxers. No, I wouldn't be. I mean, these are the same people who think crystals cure people.
Well, yeah, that doesn't surprise me either. I mean, because there's. The mindsets and notions that people buy into,
the Facebook group that Facebook still hasn't shut down, Stop Mandatory Vaccination, has 178,000 members. Now, just sort of do that old shampoo commercial where she tells one person, and that person tells one person, and multiply that by 178,000.
Yeah, I think YouTube has started to crack down on that shit. There was a lot of that shit also on YouTube. I don't know. It's heartbreaking that such stuff is allowed. I mean, I'm a big believer in people having freedom of expression and freedom of thought and all that stuff. But when it's blatant nonsense...
Well, not just when it's blatant nonsense, when it impacts the ability of a four-year-old to become a five-year-old.
That's what I mean.
That's generally the line of demarcation where the state says we've got a right to step in and says so correctly.
Now, hopefully we haven't heard the last of this, and that somebody, some
there's not a word in any of the stories I've read about this saying that charges are contemplated against the mother.
Jesus, crazy.
And our buddy Dr. John did some fantastic work a year or so ago, looking at the religious exemption to vaccination law in New Mexico.
Yeah,
and he did the hard journalism work of going and looking at some of the exemption letters. Very few letters from doctors saying, you know, this child would be put at hazard from vaccinations. And some of them are just handwritten notes by barely literate people saying, oh, my child, you know, sort of, you can hear the grunting as they struggle to write on the paper. My child had no shot.
Yeah. Well, that'd be small potatoes right down there, Bob.
Yeah, Joey, Jesus, it never stops with you, does it? How does giraffe...
There's all kinds of potatoes. Does it matter what variety? Like, you have these Idaho Bakers.
Well,
if
it's a four-year-old, you're never going to get one of those good steakhouse potatoes in his socks. You'd never get his foot in the sock with it. So, you know, you probably want some what we call graveling potatoes. New potatoes. Or maybe some of those Peruvian purple fingerlings. Lady B responding said, I literally yelled, oh my God, out loud while mopping. Yep, as perfect as the view is here in Colorado, we're chock full of crazies. Keep in mind, they bring this shit with them. I suppose we have enclaves, but we leave those motherfuckers alone. Those folks are batshit insane. We leave them to themselves. And generally, that's a pretty good idea until it gets out of hand and, you know, four-year-olds start dropping dead.
Yeah.
And as Steve in New York points out, anti-vaxxer lefties, wasn't Jenny McCarthy the big famous person who championed that shit? Isn't RFK Jr. an anti-vaxxer? That would be yes and yes.
Yeah. Sadly. Well, Christ, you can hardly get any member of the Kennedy family to speak up about the demise of their own uncle, you know. So you're not, you know, I don't expect them to be on board with solid, established science and medicine, which is weird because they're believers in polluting, you know, and saving the planet, aren't they? I mean.
Oh, yeah. No, RFK Jr. takes a backseat to no one in his environmental activism. I mean, he came all the way down to Southern West Virginia and made a movie about mountaintop removal. And there's a passage in that movie where he says, well, we're going to see if we can't build some, can't get some wind turbines built down here. And then as soon as the movie came out, we never heard from him again. Oops. I know some friends up in Wisconsin wanted him to come up and maybe get involved in the struggle against destroying the Pinokies. And he said if they could come up with a check for $30,000, he'd be right there.
Yeah, I was not long ago listening to an interview with John Barber, you know, who was the host of Real People back in the 70s.
Yeah.
And he's real big on the JFK case. And in his book that I finished reading a couple of weeks ago, he talks about trying to deal with Bobby Kennedy's kid. I guess it was RFK Jr. To get him to go on record or to appear in one of John's documentaries about the JFK case. And he kept being led on by these people, you know, saying that they were on board and they believed in what he was doing. And the project and all that. But when it came right down to it, they were like no-shows, literally no-shows. So I'm sorry, Sparky, were you saying that Steve from Georgistan's not with us today?
Yeah, so far, no.
Well, that's because normally when he's on Fridays, he'll ask me about a TV viewing tip, and I have one. And this one's especially for Bob. maybe the word will get back to him, or we can conjure him into the call, you know?
Yeah.
But a couple of days ago, we got to talking about Zero Mostel.
Yes.
And tonight on TCM, back-to-back movies with Zero Mostel. One of them is The Front, which also stars Woody Allen. It wasn't directed by Woody Allen, but it's about the blacklisting in the 50s. It's excellent, excellent movie. I think everybody in America should watch it.
Yeah, probably being screened as a result of the recent passing of Kirk Douglas.
Well, and a lot, the strange thing is a lot of the people who made that movie, The Front, were themselves blacklisted in real life. Zero Mostel, Martin Ritt, the director, screenwriter.
But alongside Otto Preminger, Kirk Douglas was instrumental in breaking the blacklist.
Yes, definitely. When he hired Dalton Trumbo for
well, not just hired him, when he made his contribution to the screenplay public.
Otto
Preminger actually did it first, also with Dalton Trumbo, but Douglas's movie premiered in like September, and Preminger's premiered a couple of months later in December.
Which Preminger movie was that? Was that Exodus or did?
Yeah, it was Exodus. It was Exodus.
Yeah. Okay. But anyway, The Front is on tonight, and it's followed by Funny Thing Happened on the way to the forum. Both of them featuring Zero Mostel. Yep. God, what a man. What a creative
obviously,
man
you know, the serious film, and then you get to lighten up and feel a little less horrible after when you watch A Funny Thing Happen on the way to the forum.
And Comedy Tonight on TCM. And if you miss it, if you subscribe to TCM on your cable or satellite or whatever, you can get access to the app and watch them for several weeks after they've originally aired, which is always good, too.
Oh, I'm getting an update from David in South Carolina, Stan. I'm getting an update from David in South Carolina, Stan. Weather in North Georgia. They had and have some bad weather in North Georgia with some snow, ice, flooding, depending on where Steve lives. He's probably touched by all that. He may not even have any electricity right now. People were killed in the deep south yesterday as a result of the horrible weather.
Oh, but there's no climate disruption, folks. Nothing to see here.
No, happens all the time in February in the deep south. Even though, you know, that's the season for that has traditionally begun March and April, but tradition is dead. I need to send out thanks. Thank you very kindly to Brendan. Brendan, we really, really appreciate it. We are down now to $480 to go to finish the week. Thank you, Brendan. And hopefully we'll just push it on a little further as we go. And eventually I'll order that new computer. Damn it. But we're down to $480, and that's a beginning. And thank you very kindly to Ralphs and Brendan and Steve in New York for getting us started. Let's see. You know, Darlene's in the room. Hey, Darlene.
Oh, yeah. Hi. So now you finally get to me. I'm upset with you, Bob.
What have I done now?
I am upset with you because you ignored what I proffered in a prior program. I'm trying to use alliterations. Granted, it was not a pure alliteration, so let me revise. How about Pussy Probus?
Oh, I thought I had that. I thought I mentioned that.
Probus was, he was a Caesar.
Yes.
He was an emperor. And according to Wikipedia, take it with a grain of salt, Marcus Aurelius Probus Augustus was an active and successful general, as well as a conscientious administrator, and in his reign of 6 years, he secured prosperity for the inner provinces while withstanding repeated blah, blah, blah. So, Pussy Probus. And I was thinking about that at the same time that Tracy brought up her pussy grabbing blah, blah, blah. So we were thinking along the same lines. So there you go.
Yeah, no comment. No comments about the sorority members all thinking of the same thing at the same time. I mean, yeah, we'll just leave that alone.
We ladies are on the same wavelength. Yes. So I think Pussy Probus, granted I said Pussy Grabber, so it wasn't a pure alliteration, but. And the other thing that was distressing was, and I have to study it a little bit more, and maybe you mentioned it, I didn't quite hear it, but that DC court ruled that Congress is barred from suing President Trump. Individual members of Congress are barred over suing him for his business dealings.
Yeah, the emoluments, the emoluments.
The emoluments issue that was led by, I think it was led by my illustrious Connecticut State Senator Richard Blumenthal. So even though, you know, and maybe there's a good reason for that. But again, you know, considering what's happened recently, what's transpired recently, clearly he's, you know, Trump is going to see that as a victory, which he did. He tweeted, you know, another win just in, you know, so he's going to see it as a win. And
he was bellowing about it at the helicopter.
Exactly. Pad. Exactly, Scott. He was bellowing about it. And Blumenthal said that, and Nadler, you know, they said that this was not a decision made on the merits. And it's interesting because I guess it was made by three judges that, according to the Washington Post, were across the political spectrum. But if you're talking about three judges, then at least two of them had to have been appointed by one or the other side. So I'm curious as to, you know, how many Republicans appointed those justices.
Well, I actually did go and have a look at it, Darlene, and I'm not quite. I mean, Pussy Probus is not known for the incisiveness of his legal analysis.
Great.
You're making me work here.
Probus? Hell no, he missed us.
Wrecked him. Damn near killed him.
Well, Pussy Probus is a good one. You got to chalk that. That's a good one, yeah. I think.
Well, especially if you can.
Pussy.
Especially if you can work in analysis.
Pussy Perineum. Tracy, weigh in. Yes. Yeah,
let me just work through this, because what Gerald Nadler said is absolutely true. They did not reach a decision on the merits.
On the merits,
which means that they didn't go to the question of whether or not he had violated the emoluments clause. Instead, they said that the various members of the legislature do not have the standing to sue because they were not acting as part of a majority. Which is interesting, because that tends to indicate that if the thing were to be, say, dismissed and relitigated, you know, dismissed without prejudice, then if a majority of the House of Representatives, you know, which is Democrats, sign on to the lawsuit, then that standing question would be obviated.
Well, it's the 200 Democrats in Congress.
Yeah, but that's
that wasn't enough.
No, that's 200 members of the House and Senate taken together. And since the since the Senate could not form the Democrats can't get a majority in the Senate, that was the hook that this three-judge panel hung its hat on. Now the other thing, and I would certainly expect it in this case, is that when you get shot down by a three-judge panel of the circuit, and this is the D.C. Circuit, you can appeal of right for a hearing en banc, and that is for the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals to hear it sitting all together and not just three judges pulled at random.
Right.
Yeah, the judges were David S. Tatel, T-A-T-E-L, Thomas B. Griffith, and Karen LaCraft Henderson. So I'd be curious to know who appointed.
All right, let's do that kind of slow. Like, I'll be the research department. T-A-T-E-L.
T-A-T-E-L, David S. T-A-T-E-L, Tattle.
He has been on the D.C. circuit since 1994. He replaced Ruth Bader Ginsburg when she was elevated by Clinton. So, okay.
Thomas B. Griffith with two F's. G-R-I-F-F-I-T-H. Thomas B. Griffith.
He was appointed by W.
Okay, and the final is Karen LeCraft Henderson with an S-O-N. Henderson. LeCraft, L-E, capital C-R-A-F-T, Henderson.
Okie dokie. And she was appointed by old 666 himself. No. She was appointed by Pappy Bush, and she replaced Ken Starr.
Oh, but of course.
She was originally appointed by old 666 himself, Ronald Wilson Reagan, to serve on the district court in where? Yes, the home of American sedition, South Carolina.
Okay, Washington Post. So when you say the ruling from these, from the three judges appointed by presidents across the political spectrum, that's kind of bullshit.
Yeah,
we've got.
Yeah, why not just say the panel was comprised of two Republican appointees and one Democrat appointee?
Yeah, it would be a hell of a lot more accurate. I'm trying to see, and of course, you know, again. Oh, sorry. Go ahead. Sorry. Go ahead, Joey.
I was just going to add, you could go with, pussy perineum probus. Get your alliteration on there.
That's perfect. That's even better. I love that.
But in the larger issue of the litigation itself, this is what courts like to do when they don't like to reach an ultimate conclusion. Because the other thing is there's still a significant amount.
That's wow. Tracy, that's cool.
Oh, okay.
That's all right.
I was just letting them pass. But the thing is there are other emoluments cases still in the pipeline, and in some of those judges have refused to dismiss. And so you'll probably wind up with a split of decisions in the circuits, which means almost an automatic trip to the Supreme Court.
There's a line here, but we will not, indeed, we cannot participate in this debate. That's basically, in other words, they're saying they're doing a pass.
Which is really kind of a bullshit approach to it, because one of the fundamental problems about the emoluments clause is the fact that it has been so seldom litigated, because generally presidents have tried to obey the law in regard to emoluments. And, it applies to other members of government as well, but the constitutional language is interesting and seems fairly clear, but it does not have an interpretive history in terms of stare decisis coming from the Supreme Court. So for the D.C. Circuit to punt on this in a case that is arguably a case of first impression, which means hasn't really been considered before, then that is a weird. That's a weird approach to take, but it's obviously an approach that these three judges badly wanted to take.
Mm.
It's tough to win a motion for reconsideration en banc, but since it is a case of first impression, there might be a chance of it happening. And I don't know. Oh. I don't know what the overall breakout in terms of appointments is on. On the D.C. Circuit.
Well, he said lawmakers could ask the full court to rehear the case or seek review from the Supreme Court, but that seems less likely because the D.C. Circuit decision was unanimous. And just to, I probably should give the Washington Post a little bit more credit instead of criticism, but they did indicate near the end that who appointed whom. So it confirms that Tattle was appointed by Bill Clinton, Griffith by W, and Henderson by H.W. Herbert Walker. So they did put that in there. But it was a 12-page opinion.
Trump said, "I'll be reading it on the helicopter." Now, I had to laugh out loud at that. There's no fucking way he's going to read. He wouldn't read 12 pages of Green Eggs
It just came out a few minutes ago, so I'll be reading it on the helicopter. But it was a total win. A total win. It was another phony case, and we won it 3-0. We won it unanimously.
And to those who only know what he says, is utterances at the heliport pad on the South Lawn, to those who only know that as the end-all and be-all of reality, these other cases, which probably stand a way better chance, these emolument cases, have yet to be run through the system.
Well, and no, they're making their way. And one of them will be decided by, it's before the Fourth Circuit right now, and the Fourth Circuit will not have the out that the D.C. Circuit did because it's been brought by a pair of attorneys general, who don't have to have a majority of anybody because they're the attorneys general.
Right.
So that's gone. And the other emoluments case is brought, I think that's the one that was brought by people who have actually been negatively economically impacted by his flagrant violation of the clause.
Yeah, there's more cases pending.
Restaurateurs, hoteliers. Yeah.
Well, there was, I guess, a Fordham University law professor, Jed Sugarman, assisted, you know, my senator and other plaintiffs in this case, and said that the Democrats could still boost their case by adding to the lawsuit the names of lawmakers who have joined the House since it filed. This was pending since 2017.
Yeah, people leapt out and filed these things, but what I find interesting is, you know, they. And the problem is, oh God, when you file
he criticized them. Yeah.
When you file one of these things and they filed it early, that mm-hmm. means and it's taken this long to get to that level, then if it's just dismissed and you refile, let's say you refile as a majority of the House, and no senators need apply. Then we're talking about 2024 for getting a resolution. At which point, if it gets all the way to the Supreme Court, then they'll say, "Well, we're going to bounce this on the concept of mootness because Trump isn't president anymore."
Right, and this law professor that originally advised the plaintiffs criticized them as well because, according to this Washington Post article, he said it seems to have been a blind spot of the organizers, like Blumenthal and others, not to make that effort to reach out, I guess, to more members of the House. And he said that the judge, ultimately, he said, and this is what's chilling, that the judge's decision is extremely disappointing, largely because they appeared to argue that the Constitution was not likely to effectively rein in corruption. So again, this is another, you know, nail in the coffin for the Constitution.
Yeah, and Flavio responded and said, "So now this country is like the worst Latin American countries where graft is the norm.
or maybe any country can devolve into that if their citizens are gullible or greedy or both. You know, you might argue that it's a function of the evolutionary process of republics.
Okay, that's interesting.
On an entirely separate and unrelated topic, I was pondering the concept of homelessness earlier today. And I came back around to the notion that homelessness, because I was reading an article about homelessness in L.A., and in particular in Koreatown, and homelessness does never, you have to go back.
Is this when I chime in?
Not yet. You have to understand that the original, the Greek root word from which we get the word politics, political, politician, is polis. Pi, omicron, lambda, iota, sigma. Polis. And it means the town or the city. And so politics becomes the life business of the community. Community is probably the best word for polis, because then you get in, otherwise you get into distinctions between, well, New York's a city, but, you know, Beckley's a city, but it's not a city like New York's a city, and blah, blah, blah. Community probably works best in that sense. And so you can't reach a conclusion about homelessness without engaging politics. And ultimately, it is a matter of fact. I don't think either side can argue against this, that homelessness does not exist because homelessness is just something that attends having a community. Homelessness exists as a choice, and not a choice on the part of the homeless. People who are homeless in L.A. right now would not be homeless in practically any community in West Virginia. Okay, because it does not cost $1,000 to have a studio apartment, or more than $1,000 to have a studio apartment in Beckley. Okay? It may not be great, but it ain't no $1,000. And so if you're on a fixed income and you're bringing in maybe $1,200, $1,500 a month, you can't have a $1,000 studio apartment in L.A. So it is a matter of choice on the part of the polis. We choose to be a culture that has poverty. We choose to be a culture that has homelessness, because we choose not to create meaningful remedies thereto. And in large part, we make those choices because of things like the free market and capitalism. And to the same extent, so the reason I said that it is separate, is that we choose to a certain extent to have broken government like this. And by the way, the news just broke that Gordon Sondland has been fired. The purge, the Stalinist purge is on. And for anybody who thinks I'm being over the top in saying Stalinist, I'm not. Because if you think for one minute that Pussy Probus would not have these people shot if it was within his power, well, you haven't been paying attention.
You're right. Yeah, you're absolutely right. And just to get back to the homelessness point, I mean, at least here in Connecticut, it's starting to, I mean, we're seeing problems. I write for, I mean, I was writing for like 3 battered women's shelters at one time as a grant writer. And we're seeing more and more problems with what they call situational homelessness, that there's just not enough affordable housing for people that are in, like, quote unquote, a situation and need to leave their batterer or the abuser or the batterer, and they can't find, they have to go into a shelter or emergency safe housing, and there's nothing affordable for them to transition into. It's taking a lot longer. So the classically homeless, quote unquote, there's also the situational homeless. It's becoming a huge problem here in Connecticut. We're seeing that. So, and I'm sure that's you know, and indicative across the country.
And in a place like L.A., it is a function of the avarice of property owners that they don't, you know, Airbnb, for instance, has had a tremendous negative impact on the availability of housing. I mean, there's one statistic out there that says there are actually 5 vacant houses for every homeless person in this country.
Mm-hmm.
And they're sitting there vacant because the owners, Airbnb. because the owners want to make jacked up rates out of turning them into little hotel spaces. Hey, Tracy.
Hey, Trace.
Yeah, no, it's crazy. When I had, in 1988, when I had Alex, I was working part-time at Ralph's. I was a journeyman cashier. I was making $17 an hour in 1988. Now it was part-time, but you know, I could get more hours, or I could, you know, either at my store or a neighboring Ralph's, whatever the case may be. My rent in Leimert Park for a 1-bedroom apartment was $300 a month. On average, let's see, because I was getting 40 hours a week, typically 40 hours a week. So I was probably making, I can't do the math, but y'all do the math for me. I had, you know, either, you know, sometimes I had a car, sometimes I did it, but I got around because the bus where I lived, I was able to get around on the bus. So it wasn't that difficult. I had full insurance. I had, you know, I was fine. Yeah. And I was able to save money. It was, you know, so I did save enough money to eventually buy a car. This was in 1988. My rent, like I said, was $300 a month. A month.
That's amazing.
In LA. Now, this was in 1988. Now, I got hurt on the job, and I lost my apartment, and I had to move into a shelter. Now, it wasn't like a typical shelter, you know, a big room, rows of beds and stuff like that. It was actually an apartment in Koreatown, you know. I mean, you should even mention Korea. It was basically a 1-bedroom apartment that I shared with Alex and I had basically what it would have been the living room. The other family, another family, single mom with her family, had the other room. We shared the bathroom and the kitchen. Alex and I were there for a few months, and then we got our Section 8 voucher. We moved to the Valley. My portion of the, now even moving into the, so this was in 92, my rent for a 2-bedroom townhouse was $550 a month in 1992.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, it sounds like we may have lost Tracy.
Oh, shoot.
Well,
I got a question for Darlene.
Uh-oh, okay. Go ahead, Sparky.
You ever heard of a Mark Stewart Greenstein?
Sounds familiar.
He ran for governor of your state on the...
70. What happened?
Okay. The
Alliance. Am I still talking?
Well, you broke up, Tracy. Sparky jumped in with a question. Just one sec. Mark Stewart Greenstein ran for governor.
And he was the Amigo Constitution Party.
Yeah, I'm seeing.
Well, he's on my ballot for president. There's 20 people on the California ballot.
That's hilarious. Okay.
Four people I've never even heard of before.
Connecticut Citizen Action Group in Hartford.
I got one ballot.
I don't want to interrupt Tracy. She was had an important story about her time as housing. Go ahead, Trace.
So in 1992, I moved to Sherman Oaks, and my rent was $725 for a two-bedroom apartment, but it was rent control. So if an apartment was built before 1970-something, it's rent control, and your rent can only go up 3% a year. So by the time I moved out of my apartment, we moved out of the apartment 4 years ago. When I moved out of my apartment, my rent was only $1,100 a month. I know my landlord, the owner of that building, the rent now was like $2,500 a month for that very same apartment. Who can afford that?
And you know what? It helped you, Tracy, because look at where you're at today. I mean, you've got one of the most lauded diet, programs out there asking you to be basically a counselor for them.
Yes. And so, as of today, I am now down.
Amazing.
57.4 pounds.
You go, girl.
As of today, I swam 500 yards today.
That's amazing.
I swam 20 laps today.
You're such an inspiration.
You saw that ice cream sundae. I said, fuck that shit. I'm eating the ice cream. I needed this. I was tired. My ass was dragging. You can see the drag marks across the, because I needed the sugar. As Bob, I've been up since 4 o'clock this morning. I was tired as fuck.
But you know what, Tracy? That's okay, because, you don't want to keep denying yourself too much, because otherwise you're going to go off the rails if you keep denying yourself. But you're like, it sounds like you're just, to me, you're making some incredible progress on so many fronts lately. And it's like you're hitting this, you've hit this mode where you're just doing some incredible things and making incredible progress in the areas that you want to. So good on you. And it's okay that you took that Sunday down. I think that's great.
The funny thing is I couldn't finish the whole thing. I did my damnedest. I tried. Oh, God damn, I tried. Here's the thing, darling. Here's the secret. Now, here's the thing about me and sweets, because I have a crazy sweet tooth.
Me too.
But the thing about me and sweets, once I get a taste of something, I'm good. I get a, and this is one of those things that drives Jan crazy. It really actually, it's kind of pathological. It really, really fucking pisses her off that I can take a couple of bites of something and I'm good. It's like, okay, I'm good. I don't need any more. And she's like, wait, what? We'll have a box of something, like a box of See's candy, and I'll take maybe one or two pieces, and I don't need it anymore, because I just need a taste.
I just need a little something.
Just enough. But there are some things that, if I start, then I can't stop, like pasta. See, I'm a pasta hoe. So a lot of times, not all the time, but if you catch me at that right time, I can go through a thing of pasta, but typically, it comes in waves. But it's just, I have worked so incredibly hard.
Yep.
But I do not deny. This is like when I hear people, oh girl, I can't. Oh girl, that. The first time a motherfucker tells me I can't have, that's when I want it all. That's when I want all the carbs.
Carbs are tough.
I want it all. and say, you know, I want it. I want it all. So that's why I love Weight Watchers. Because Oprah says I can have it all. Oprah, but if Oprah says you can have cake, you can have cookies, have bread. I my carbs and plus it's what I call it the combination of run, shuffle, walk, meander, depending on how tired I am or what time it is. That's I need. You need carbs. You yes. not only you need carbs for that energy. You need the carbs. So it's like these food, these people with just the keto. I'm sorry. Yes, you lose that weight really quickly, but you look like hell. And I'm sorry. No, I want my carbs. But you know what? Thank you, Darlene. You know what? One of some of the things that keep me moving and keeps me going a lot of times is when I, you know, when I'm doing that 18th lap or whatever the fuck I'm doing. I think about you. My Horn family, and I think about how you guys, I hear you guys in my head cheering me on, because trust me, a month from today, when I'm doing that triathlon, I'm going to have to hear, I'm gonna hear all y'all going, bitch, move, keep going.
When you're doing a triathlon, when are you going to start riding a bike?
Listener.
I rode my bike. No. I did. I've been riding my bike. I rode on Super Bowl Sunday. Oh, okay. So Saturday we did a race practice. I learned how to rack my bike for the triathlon on Saturday. And then Sunday I actually did a mini triathlon. I did a triathlon on my own. So, cause you know, I'm training for a half marathon as well. I don't know if I told you guys that. So I did a long on Super Bowl Sunday. Instead of watching the Super Bowl, I did a 10K on my own because I had to do a long run. That's so amazing. I did a 10K, and I rode my bike for 6 miles. So I did a, so I ran 6 miles. I did a 10K.
Jesus.
I rode my bike for 6 miles. I ran for 6 miles, and then I did a 150-meter swim. Well, sort of, kind of, because the pool at the Rose Bowl. It's a 50-meter lane, which was terrifying because I've only done 25 yards. And let me tell you, I sat at the edge of that pool for a good 20 minutes and stared and tried not to cry. Mm-hmm. And so, no, scary. So I did the first lap. Okay, that was fine. Did the second lap. But when I did that third lap, I got to the middle of the lane. And I'm like, oh, shit, what have I done? I didn't panic. I turned over on my back and made like an otter.
Now you know where I'm still Tracy's going to get through the triathlon. She's going to get through the half marathon, but I'm not going to be happy until next winter comes and she does the biathlon.
Ooh. Are you still trying to get me on the skis?
No, wait. Strong black woman skiing and shooting at shit. You'll probably win just because everybody.
You got to be careful though. Skiing can be really dangerous. It can really fuck up your knees.
Like Sonny Bono and.
Well, I don't think you're that stupid.
Be careful. Not even that. It can really mess up your knees.
It's cross country skiing.
Oh, okay. It's physically demanding, but Tracy, you're up to it because
yeah, it's cross country ski, shoot things. I mean,
cross country. Okay,
you'll win because all the yuppie white people be like, I'm skiing my ass out here. Black woman with a gun. Black woman with a gun.
Shade to the Black Panthers. In Sacramento.
They done turned into White Panthers. You know. Got that white ski suit on.
I might just do that for the visual. Just for the visual.
I'm telling you.
Oh, jeez.
But wait a minute. No, I can't. I'm a convicted felon. I can't have a gun. That part.
Maybe it's an air rifle. Maybe they're using air rifles now.
I can't. Unless they change the law, I can't have a gun.
So well, you can petition for the restoration of your right.
that's a good
maybe
question.
The NRA, hey, maybe the NRA might be good for something. Hey.
Most states, in most states, felons, particularly nonviolent felons, can petition for the restoration of their Second Amendment rights.
Well, what if you're just, what if it's like a fake gun? What if it's like a air gun or something? Are you screwed? Like, supposing Tracy does a joke. She's on her cross-country skis with air.
No. Tracy is black. And that triggers the Tamir Rice effect.
Right.
Hey, I got a note from Ron in Raleigh. Housing and homelessness. Back in the 1970s, I worked at an architectural firm that designed affordable housing financed by the federal government, counties, and the state. When old 666, Ronald Wilson Reagan himself, was elected, all the programs to build housing were scrapped. And vouchers became the norm. Landlords don't accept vouchers if market rates rise above what they can get with vouchers. Not a stick of federally financed housing has been built since. I blame Barack and Tim Geithner for making the banks whole and leaving homeowners to hang fire. The federal government gave a bank for $0 to Steve Mnuchin and all the mortgages that bank was holding. The renters are driving up rents and homelessness. The rentiers. I'm sorry, not renters. The landlords are driving up rents and homelessness, and it's an evolutionary process. You know who didn't have homelessness? I mean, I'm just saying. Hunter gatherers didn't have homelessness.
Mm.
Tribal peoples don't have homelessness.
Mm.
You know, another reason why I have a little shit bit every time I hear some privileged ass wealthy person talking about, especially in the media, our tribalism is on display. Really? Our tribalism is on display, motherfucker? That must mean we don't have any homelessness anymore and no hungry people, because tribal peoples don't let people go hungry and homeless. Oops!
Well, what's really remarkable, the time frame that Tracy was talking about, late 80s, very early 90s, it sounds like it was only a couple of years on the Section 8 waiting list. Do you know what it is now? When I signed up for it years ago, they said it would be about 8 years on average. It turned out to be closer to 12.
Hey, Scott, is that because of it's California and the real estate and the housing prices are so astronomical?
Again, it comes down to what Bob was saying, choosing. A society needs to choose. And in some places, societies and communities choose not to allow, or at least to try to alleviate homelessness, or even more drastic for people is affordable housing. You know?
By way of answering your question, Darlene, The Section 8 waiting list in this state can be years long too.
And also,
it's incredible.
To answer Darlene's question is like Bob was saying about choosing. When I had my Section 8 voucher, the building that I used to live in, the woman that owned the building was really sweet, took my voucher, no issue. Then the fucking slumlord that bought the building from her. Mm-hmm. After he bought it, he took it for 2 years, and then after two years, he refused to take it any longer.
Mm-hmm.
Fortunately, by the time he stopped taking it, I was in the process of no longer needing Section 8, and I had gotten a good job, so it didn't matter. But the problem is, a lot of people stopped taking the vouchers.
Yeah, see, the other part of the problem is finding a property owner who will accept the vouchers. I was very fortunate in that I've got a landlord. When I was living at the other place, when the voucher finally came through, she said, well, you might want to consider moving to one of our other places and go from a studio to a one-bedroom. And it actually worked out very, very well, you know. And, you know, I pay my portion, and the county or the city, whatever, pays their portion.
And see, yeah. And
but
then when
the demand far outreaches the supply, not just of affordable housing, but also landlords who will participate willingly in the program.
And on top of that, because he wanted me to move, but I'm like, oh no, because see, I could have kept my voucher. Now here's another thing, I also could have kept my voucher because you know Alex and I were living in Sherman Oaks. But if I wanted to keep my voucher, I was going to move to a not so desirable neighborhood. And I'm like, yeah, a single mother with a young black son moving to, you know, Panorama City, Van Nuys, Pacoima. Yeah, no, that was not going to happen. So I did what I had to, you know, stay in Sherman.
Oh, Tracy's going into another bad zone. Well, Tracy, I hope you can hear me because Ron and Raleigh, now that you're having all these successes, Ron and Raleigh, it happens about this time every year. Ron and Raleigh want you to come visit your mama about this time next year and then go to Raleigh for the Krispy Kreme 5-mile run.
This seems like a...
Would that be a dichotomy or an irony or
addiction to terms? That's great. What do they do? Eat a bunch of Krispy Kreme?
Yeah, you eat Krispy Kremes and run.
Oh, that's bad. I can understand eating the Krispy Kremes after the run, but how?
You want me to eat a Krispy Kreme and then run?
Exactly.
Actually,
exactly.
I think it's Tracy. 5K or is it? Tracy, I think it's I think it's plural. I think it's Krispy Kremes.
How far is the run? Seriously though, how far is the run?
It's 5K.
The only way they'd get me to do it is if there was that Krispy Kremes run is at the end of the track that there'd be a table full of Krispy Kremes for me to gouge myself.
Oh, there is at the beginning, too. That's the whole thing, I think.
Ah, okay.
I'm going to have to Google that when I get home because that's out. I mean, it depends.
Well, they just did it. They just held it last week. So you could plan a trip to visit Mama, and then you could go do the Krispy Kreme 5K.
But are the Krispy Kremes free?
Yeah,
they better be.
that's not my question. What I want to know is, are they hot nows? Because if those suckers aren't hot, it ain't worth the effort. I mean, a Krispy Kreme that's not hot is just another donut.
No, it has to be. There has to be a caveat. They have to be the hot Krispy Kreme. I'm not fucking around with a cold Krispy Kreme. Fuck that, no.
I mean, for that, you can go to Dunkin' Donuts.
Right. If I want a cold fucking donut, I'll just go to goddamn Dunkin' Donut.
Well, listen, I want to go on record, Tracy.
Now, wait a minute. I have to tell you. Now, I've gotten, okay, so I have a slight guilty pleasure at Dunkin' Donut. Now, okay, we got to keep this on a down low on this one. The strawberry
put your arm in the air, Tracy. Stand on one line.
I heard
I have a P.O. box, and right next door to the P.O. box is a fucking duck. Now when I go check my mail, I walk to my P.O. box because that's what I do. And one day I was walking and I went to the Dunkin' Donuts and I saw the damn strawberry and I tried it and God help me, it was actually kind of tasty. So every so often I get me a strawberry frosted Dunkin' Donut. That is my sin.
Well, listen, I've got nothing but admiration for you with your various athlons. I mean, I get tired hearing you talk about it. I get winded. Listen, I get winded I get winded carrying a basket of laundry around the back to do a load of laundry. I mean, I'm woefully out of shape.
Scott, I used to get winded. Let me tell you, I used to get winded walking from my front door to my car.
Oh,
when
man.
I would do my school run, let me tell you, I'd have to, let me, do, and this is, and, you know, all joking aside, I would have to leave my house early to go pick up Pendy so I can take, I would get to her house early so I could take a nap to have the energy to drive from her, to drive from her house to her school. And then I would have to take another nap after I dropped her off to drive from her school back to my house.
Well, this is what I mean. The commitment and discipline on your part, Tracy, and we've been listening as you over the months have been talking about your steady progress. It's just absolutely commendable. I mean, there's no other way to describe it.
Yes, there is. It's inspiring.
Well, no, let's not go crazy.
So, Tracy, have you dropped 60 full pounds now? Did you meet your goal?
57.4.
57.4. You're going to be there. You're going to be there.
I now weigh 220 pounds.
Oh, my God. You're like about where I am now.
220. But you're how tall are you?
Well, okay. Yeah. 6'1".
Tracy, what was the donut? You said the donut from Dunkin' Donuts was a strawberry. You dropped out. It was a strawberry something.
Yeah, strawberry frosted with fucking sprinkles.
Was it worth it, Tracy?
Yes, it was.
All right.
Okay, we're getting a little clarification on the Krispy Kreme run. Now, Ron says miles. I'm guessing it's kilometers. But Ron says you run.
It's a 5K, so it's a 3.1 mile.
Right, but he said Ron just wrote and said you run the Krispy Kreme run is you run 2.5 miles, eat a dozen Krispy Kremes, then you run 2.5 more miles. With the number of runners, they're coming off the conveyor continuously. So they are hot.
Krispy Kreme.
How do you, after eating a box of Krispy Kremes, I would go straight into a sugar coma. I could barely sit, much less walk or run.
Krispy Kreme run, Raleigh.
We're at 20 past, and of course this is the end of the first full week of the of February, and we're kind of stuck on minus 480 to end the week. It's ugly and scary.
No, you're right. 5 miles, 12 donuts, 1 hour.
Okay, so it's miles. But we're at 480 to go to finish the week. That means today, yesterday, and $80 of Wednesday we didn't quite keep up with. So there are people on this call who are really, really good about keeping this program on the air. And if you value these conversations and you haven't kicked in a while, this would be a lovely time so to do and stand shoulder to shoulder with the people who so regularly and routinely keep this program on the air. So I hate breaking up the conversation to talk about that, but when you get, you know, starting Monday at 6:80, Jesus Christ. There are $1,500 worth of bills that are waiting to be paid for this, you know, for the month. Darlene, don't. You do a lot as it is, and I want, and Tracy does, and everybody, you know, and folks kick in as they can, and I just hope that folks will respond, knowing what people like you, Darlene, and our anonymous friends, and Ralphs, and Chris, and all the other subscribers do. I'm just, you know, it'd be great to see some new names.
And it would be,
because as Brother Deacon Asa did the homework, and for every 100 listeners to this program, one, only one, kicks in to help keep it on the air.
Mm.
That's pretty profound.
Yeah. Hey, Bob, is it possible, you know how you always talk about Ruth Bader Ginsburg, we would lend her our hearts and our livers and everything to keep her going?
Yeah.
I'm wondering if we should elevate Judge Emmett G. Sullivan to that level as well.
Is he sick?
No. I'm just saying, you know, at the D.C. appeals court level, he cleared the way.
Yeah.
According to, for lawmakers to issue 37 subpoenas seeking financial information, interviews, and other records, you know, including the ones related to Trump Tower and Mar-a-Lago Club in South Florida. He was the one that came right out and said concerning Michael Flynn, you know, did he commit treason? He was pissed, and he's an African-American appeals court judge that, you know, I think is a gem that we need right now, considering what's happening with the judicial branch.
I agree. And but the thing is,
isn't he just the district judge though, darling?
Yeah, he's a district judge.
He's a DC appeals court. Yes, he is a district court judge.
District of DC.
Yes.
District court.
Sorry,
the thing is, the business with the subpoenas though, and correct me if I'm wrong, Billable Rick, this is basic clinical program in law school law. This is black letter law done in a Sharpie.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the legislative branch has an inherent power to issue subpoenas and get them enforced if they're not complied with. So, I mean, that's what was so obvious about the impeachment articles. I mean, the second article should have been the easiest one to vote on. But for some reason, I think your guy, Manchin, and some other people were having heartburn on that one. It's like, why? You know, do you mean Congress can't?
Wait, time out. I can answer your why.
Okay.
And it doesn't have anything to do with soul searching or the nature of the law or anything. Joe's not a lawyer. Joe's just a coal broker. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
But
yeah.
What gave him pause, I well imagine, is the nature of his constituents.
Okay.
And yeah. I insist that I am correct in this. They may never admit it. But if we are to believe, for instance, Sherrod Brown, Sherrod Brown of Ohio, the first time Flush Flimball, the oxymoron, ever heard of him, he called him Sherrod Brown of Ohio, my friend, Sherrod Brown, and assumed he was black. It's just a little moment in history.
Right.
But the thing is, Sherrod Brown wrote an op-ed that was published in the New York Times this week,
mm-hmm.
in which he said that he knew for a fact that a lot of his Republican colleagues knew that Donald Trump was as guilty as sin.
Right.
But that they refused to vote as such because they were afraid. Now, when I read that thing, my first thought was name names, Senator Brown, name names.
Yeah.
Because it has no value if it doesn't have names attached to it.
Well, there's 52 names that he could have named.
Some of them are legitimate maggots.
Well, I saw the Depends sticking up from underneath their pants, so I know they were scared, okay?
But the question is, and Sherrod Brown, my friends, Sherrod Brown didn't go there, but I will. I guess he was alluding to the idea that they were afraid that they would lose their seats in the Senate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, if you're Richard Shelby of Alabama, you're not going to lose your seat in the Senate. Okay?
Right. Right.
He replaced Howell Heflin.
Mm-hmm.
Now, how long ago was that?
It was the past, 70s? That's for sure.
80s. 70s? 80s, maybe the early 90s. And Howell voted with old 666 himself, Ronald Wilson Reagan, more often than Republicans did.
Mm-hmm.
But Howell had a D after his name.
Right, right.
Okay, so just to pursue this a little further,
mm-hmm.
Richard Shelby is not going to get primaried by some maggot in Alabama, and he's damn sure not going to lose to a Democrat.
Mm.
And the same can be said for... Lamar Alexander wasn't running for re-election, so his fear of not winning re-election didn't play into it. Nor with Mike Barrasso or Mike Enzi, I forget which one. Maybe both of those aren't. Pat Roberts in Kansas.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, they had nothing to fear, but yet they are afraid.
Yeah,
That only leaves one thing to be afraid of.
It's about people exercising their Second Amendment remedies, right, Bob?
Bingo.
Yep. Crazies.
Yeah.
Hey, Bob. Let me just put
a bow on this, okay?
Okay.
And we have to go to. We have to go to Alabama, of course, for this. A little town called Geraldine, just north of, it's a dot on the map in the last tottering foothills of the Appalachians of northeast Alabama. It's just north of Fort Payne, not too awful far from Gadsden, which is, of course, Roy Tola Moore country. Well, the assistant chief of police, a guy named Jeff Buckles, went to his Facebook page after the State of the Union, and he wrote the following. Pelosi just ripped up his speech. Roadside bomb on her way home and any other Democrats.
This is a sheriff?
This is the assistant chief of police of Geraldine, Alabama.
Jesus.
And then when he got caught, he said, I have definitely offended some people with my remarks. It just rips my heart out that our great country is so divided.
Not apology.
Yeah. And let's see. Back on February 4th, he wrote, I honestly believe that God has placed Donald Trump in the position to bring about prophecy. God bless Trump. God bless America. Well, that stupid fucker doesn't even know what the prophecy is, because he wouldn't be, he'd be saying, holy shit, we're in for it if that's the case. And so these are the kinds of people who keep Republican senators in line. These are the kinds of people that they are afraid of. This is the fear that Sherrod Brown, my friends, was talking about, but did not dare say aloud. Now, meanwhile, what happens in Geraldine? Yeah, well, yesterday, the mayor of Geraldine is Chuck Abels, and he said him and the police chief, Heath Albright, are going to get together today with the town's attorney and decide what the best course of discipline for Assistant Chief Roadside Bomb Buckles will be. As if there's a question. There's no question. This guy engaged in what, if it had been uttered by, say, an African-American dude, would be, or, God forbid, a Muslim dude or a Hispanic dude, he would be behind bars on a charge of terroristic threats.
Mm.
Trusted with a firearm. He cannot be trusted to enforce the laws of the state of Alabama and the great city of Geraldine. No.
Discharged is all he gets? How about being fucking prosecuted?
No, that's the whole point. They're not even sure if they're going to discharge him. They might issue him a reprimand if they can figure out how to spell it.
Isn't that like stochastic terrorism? Yeah. Encouraging stuff like that. It's crazy.
I mean, why isn't the FBI on his goddamn doorstep?
Yeah.
It's a, it's a two-pronged form of intimidation where he can do it. Trump will use political intimidation against anybody who deigns to speak out against him. Or if that doesn't apply, he'll sick the fucking mob on whoever it is. You know, the knuckle breathers and the mouth draggers. And see, he knows he can do it with impunity. Every new outrage that he gets by with empowers him in his mind to act out even further, act up and act out.
Yeah, yeah, no consequences. As long as he can, whatever he does meets with no consequences.
Yeah.
It gets worse. It'll be interesting to see who else he fires, who else he targets. Yeah. And he can't let things go. You know,
Darlene, before this is over, Trump is going to make Nixon's enemies list look like a roster of invitations to an Easter egg roll,
or to a White House ball, or something like that.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, it's going to be. You're going to have people on heavy-duty medicines and medications before this is over, out of fear.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I mean, looking at Nancy Pelosi, I mean, I think that what really, personally, from my perspective, what really stole the show the night of the SOTU address was Nancy Pelosi's expressions, you know, punctuated by her tearing up his speech. But her expressions throughout the speech, you know, behind him, she looked to me, she looked like she was going to break down crying. Like, I think she knew that we're in a constitutional crisis. And maybe she's, well, you know, I think she's kind of, she's protected from his, like, he can't necessarily unseat her. You know, and maybe she's our hope, our only hope at this point, you know.
Yeah, well, what was it? There's two things.
She looked devastated to me.
There's two things to note here. One is, did you see that weird ass quote? And I'm looking for it here. Let me see if Agnes sent it to me, so I think maybe I can find it on the fly. Republican said, I suspect Nancy will be the last person to be speaker for a while, which was just kind of creepy and frightening.
What the hell does that mean?
Yeah. The other thing, though, and it hasn't been remarked on, it was just a second, and then it was over. But somebody on her side of the House, at one point, toward the end-ish of his harangue, said, there was a yell or a shout, and man, she was like lightning. That finger came out, and she pointed.
Whoa!
Yes, and so said, you know who it was,
and saw you, and you saw her. I forget if it was either no or stop that.
Exactly, that was a big mistake in my opinion, because you know who it was.
Who?
It was the father of the little girl that was killed. I thought it was at.
It wasn't a member
Parkland, but I guess it was Sandy Hook. No, I think it was. It was the man that was shouting at, what about my daughter? When he brought up the gun
They removed him from the gallery.
Right. Okay. So the G. His last name begins with a G.
You talking about Gutenberg?
Yes.
Yeah, something.
Yeah, yeah, that's Fred that's Fred Gutenberg from Marjorie Stoneman Douglas.
Oh, okay.
So I thought that was a big mistake on her part, but maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I misunderstood that because I mistook what happened with C.J. Roberts refusing to. I thought it was a woman, but I guess it was Paul Ryan. So maybe I misunderstood that exchange. But I could have sworn that she was telling him to pipe down. when he had every right to say, you know, what about my daughter? He lost his daughter to gun violence.
Yeah.
You know? And, you know, interesting, because did you notice that a lot of the Democrats had a copy of the Constitution in their hands, that little booklet?
Yep.
Did you all notice that?
Yeah, I think that's the one you can get for free from the ACLU.
And it was interesting that a lot of them held that, you know, were holding that and reading it. So I don't, to me, I wish they had all stood up and fucking chucked it at them.
I think their only protest was wearing white again.
Well, that wasn't protest. That wasn't protest. That was in solidarity with women's suffrage.
Oh, that's true. It's 100th anniversary.
White was what the suffragettes wore. Let me get a couple of things out here real quick.
Okay.
I had a note from Tracy. Tracy just took us down to 455 with a note. She said, "I know you said not to, but I'm a grown ass woman and I can do whatever I want."
You go, girl.
So we're down to 455.
Don't argue with a woman on skis carrying a rifle.
Thank you, Tracy. Thank you so much. And then I got a note from Lady B. Subject line from earlier. Everybody going to start losing jobs in D.C. Folks will be leaving in droves. And believe it or not, many of them will be puzzled as to why. To paraphrase Martin Niemöller, first they came for all those other funny-looking motherfuckers who didn't look, act, or think like me. How the hell do they think shit would turn out? This isn't television. Minorities and the poor can tell you that if it walks, talks, quacks, and shits like a duck, it's motherfucking is. If you snitch, you get stitches. Don't drop the soap. Trump has been given the keys to the Lambo and the summer home. He's going to party like it's 1699. He's going to get medieval on every rich liberal elitist forever looking down on his ass. I mean, they'll only suffer the vapors, but they'll be okay. But them folks whose fathers worked themselves to death to get them into college and into the upper middle class, the ones who spent a career honoring their country by managing to sweep a shitload of scandals under the carpet, all the while puffing their chests out in disingenuous patriotism, those will be the ones he'll make sure to break. He'll have you barking at the moon, your mind having snapped because you never thought shit could go this wrong. I am not being an Omarosa when I say it's open season. Omarosa thought that since she held the lobby door open during the robbery, he'd cut her in on a few coins, stupid bitch. Trump tolerates blacks. He doesn't like us. Trump's got a list of names. He's been waiting for years to do this, and we're all going to suffer. Congrats again, Tracy, sister girl. Don't eat donuts and run, honey. That's silly. Run your 5K and then treat yourself to a donut. That right there would be better. And when you know better, well, you already know. Enjoy in the front porch, Lady B says. Still snowing here. It's good because this is the time we get our snow during the spring. Plenty of water for the year. Let's hope the rest of the year is a good one. And then adds, she wrote this to me. It's scary how good you are at imitating that type of person, talking about the feller in Geraldine, Alabama, how they act, think, and talk. I trust you're far from that type, and that's why I listen to your show. But let us take note, Horn community. Folks like Bob live, hell, grew up around these folks. They know just how dangerous they are. Buckle up. God damn it, it's going to be a bumpy ride.
Oh, jeez.
So
I agree with Lady B. I agree with Lady B on all counts. Treat yourself to that Krispy Kreme, those Krispy Kreme donuts after.
You won't enjoy it, dear.
This taxes the heart, and in solidarity with Lady B and Tracy, I want to make a $50 challenge. Screw you, Bob.
Well, consider me screwed.
Challenge. Let's go.
Okay, so
come
there's
on,
a,
people.
All right, we got 20 minutes to knock down a $50 challenge courtesy of Darlene. And
there's $100. All right.
I'll tell you what. It's been a while since I haven't kicked in much lately. It's kind of stressed for me financially, but I'll throw in 20. And the idea is I want to end not just Trumpism, but I want to end maggotism. I've come up with a new term, maggotism. So
get a bomb. Good one.
We've got to fight fire with fire and get rid of those guys.
Absolutely.
And did anybody see this article that just came out in Vox with James Carville?
Yeah, I did.
Democratic Party. I thought that was wonderful. I mean, he's, he had some really good points. You want me to talk about Bob? Have you talked about
him? No. You can go into it. I just need some clarification. Is that 50 you're adding to Darlene's, or is that you're jumping in on Darlene's?
I'm jumping in on Darlene's challenge.
Okay.
I'm throwing 20.
Okay. Okay. So there's 30 bucks to go on Darlene's challenge. That'll take us down to 355, which means Monday will only be at 555. So
yeah.
Please, if there's somebody out there with 30 bucks to kick in on this, that would be freaking awesome. Thank you.
That'd be awesome. Absolutely. Is this the article, billable? We're losing our damn minds.
Losing our damn minds. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I see tremendous. It now.
I mean, he points out which you never hear on mainstream media, but he, I guess, told MSNBC on a rant on Tuesday night, basically that 18% of the population controls 52 Senate seats.
Yeah.
And he says, we've got to be a majoritarian party. The urban core is not going to get it done. What we need is power. Do you understand? That's what this is about. Mm-hmm. And so he's trying to basically dismiss the idea that, look, you know, fuck the ideological purity. We need to win. There's no substitute, you know, for winning. And he also talks about the anemic turnout in the Iowa caucus and how that scares him. And Trump's approval rating is as high as it's ever been. But, you know, I don't know if I buy that 49%. I think that's horseshit myself. I think
sounds like he's been listening to Bob's program there, Billable.
What's that?
I think we got a lot of secret listeners.
I think you're right. And he also says this. He says, I'll just say it this way. The fate of the world depends on the Democrats getting their shit together and winning in November. We have to beat Trump. And so far, I don't like what I see. And a lot of people I talk to feel the same way. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he's talking about how at least in 2018, when we took over the House again, the focus was on health care. We didn't get like distracted by the shiny objects and shit like this. So when you have candidates on stage, at least this is Gordon Carville, talking about like, you know, things like open borders, decriminalizing immigration, illegal immigration, getting rid of nuclear energy and fracking, you know, letting criminals and terrorists vote from the jail cells, you know, Bernie, some of Bernie's issues, that's not going to appeal to the 18% of the people who, you know, basically caused 52 Republicans in the Senate. And,
well, yeah,
you know,
and look, I mean, the thing is, Billable,
yeah,
we've got... None of those issues you just brought up are non-issues or negligible issues or unimportant issues.
Well, they're not, but
they are the business you go about taking care of after you have power.
Right, exactly. And, you know, he says that, look, you know, Trump at Davos was talking about cutting Medicare and nobody in the party mentioned that. You know, and it was just such an obvious miss.
Well, remember, Carville is the guy, if you remember that documentary of the 92 Clinton campaign called The War Room.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Carville's the one, I believe, who hung the banner in the headquarters that said, it's the economy, stupid.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Who does he think is the answer, though? Sorry, Steve, because he says here in the article, Billable, but back to Sanders, James Carville says, what I'm saying is the Democratic Party isn't Bernie Sanders, whatever you think about Sanders.
Well, he's never been a Democrat. That's the point he's making. He's never been a member of the party. He's been an independent. But he does say, if Bernie's the nominee, I'll vote for him, no question. I'll take an ideological fanatic over a career criminal any day.
So basically, is he saying that our focus is diffused and it needs to be laser sharp?
Yes, exactly.
Well, it's that laser beam focus thing, which was another Carvilleism from the Clinton 90s. Mm-hmm. But he's also saying that you message on what you can win on. Because
right.
If you have any notion at all, and I've got mixed feelings about part of his argument. Mm-hmm. This idea, when he says the urban core of the Democratic Party isn't going to get it done, that's really kind of a snide and shitty thing to say. If you speak code, and I speak code, and you know that's saying let's not let all them brown and black people be running this show here.
Well, what he's talking about, he's talking about the so-called heartland that basically controls.
Right. He still maintains this fantasy that somehow or another you're going to bleed off some maggots
and build a coalition with some disaffected maggots.
Well,
I
maybe
think
some
that's
extent.
I think yeah. that I think seems... I think that's pathetically fictional. But
yeah, maybe
but,
so. Maybe
but,
so.
But there's still truth in what he says, in that you've got to you can't just run out there and raise issues just to make Mr. and Mrs. Midwestern High School dropout shit their pants. All right? I mean, the numbers are what the numbers are. College-educated men, white men and women, don't are far and away prone to vote Democrat. It all changes below the college level, and that's not me being an elitist. But the numbers break out pretty reliably. So you got to talk to people about the things that matter to them. And frankly, Mr. and Mrs. Midwestern America, who, you know, struggle just to read their fucking power bills and then struggle even harder to pay them, really don't care who goes PP where. Okay.
Right.
As compelling as that issue can be, and as infuriatingly bigoted and stupid as it is to be raised as an issue by these by the Republicans, and you know, the good God fearing upstanding Bible believing Christ centered evangelical fundamentalist homosexuals. Well, the bottom line is they don't care, but the thing is, the Republicans raise these issues because they know they work. They know they turn Mr. and Mrs. Midwestern America can't read my power bills bowels to water. They know that.
The famous wedge issues.
Yeah, God gays and guns.
Right.
I mean, is there anybody out there worried about the Democratic Party suddenly changing its mind and not supporting the LGBTQ community? Is that work done? No, that work is not done. There is a lot more work to do.
Mm-hmm.
Does this make any sense?
Along these lines, I've got a question. Did anybody listening today tune in on Wednesday and Thursday night to CNN for the series of town hall one-on-ones with various candidates?
No.
I recorded them and watched them all, except for maybe Deval Patrick. I didn't watch him. And there was another one I didn't watch. But one thing that struck me, and this is what gives me an icky feeling about Buttigieg, okay? That guy is too fucking smooth. There was no question from the audience that he did not have a ready answer to that was really thought out and comprehensive. I tend not to trust people who have that degree of ready answers, because some of them can trend towards simplistic and appealing to the question asker, if you get what I'm meaning.
And like I'm sorry that you all... questions? Like he was fed the questions in advance, Scott? Or
no,
what?
No, that he has been so primed to answer the variety of questions that they threw at him the other night was astounding, and he was never at a loss with a ready answer.
Well, that's
was reading it.
That shows preparedness, though. That's good.
That's preparedness, but he's also capable of some serious gobbledygook.
Yes, true.
Well, and there was a lot of that too.
And for instance, I've got an example of it here. Because Charlie Pierce tweeted this earlier, and simply said, "What in the world does this mean?" And when a longtime practitioner of the art of word knowing, like Charlie Pierce, doesn't know what something means, you know that its meaning is not clear.
Mm-hmm.
And so what Pete Buttigieg said was, "The shape of our democracy is the issue that affects every other issue."
Hmm.
The shape of our democracy? What? Round? Square? Ellipsoidal? Oblate? Yeah. Rhombus?
Well, yeah, that's one of the responses that he gave, and it's true up to a point.
Well, I don't know if it's true or not, Scott, because I don't know what the fuck it means.
Well, he described it. I'm sure these one-on-ones are online somewhere.
Then is the shape of our democracy a triangle?
Well, that's something Chauncey Gardner would say, Scott. Chauncey Gardner would have said something like that.
What he said, the question was, if you could only do one major thing, the questioner put this to him, if you can only do one major thing and solve that, what would it be? And he basically described that much of what we're seeing, it should be laying at the feet of our system not working as well as it is designed to. In other words, participation and involvement and holding candidates and elected people's feet to the fire. And he answered it that way. He said, you know, that would be the one thing that I would change. But it's the shape of the democracy is an interesting phrase, but you've got to add the explanation to it. And that's where the breakdown occurs.
Well, Buttigieg, I think there are a couple issues with him. I caught a headline that I guess he's saying that nuclear energy should be part of the mix for our energy future, okay, which is kind of concerning. But then there's also this thing out here that his campaign paid for the Iowa caucus app that screwed everything.
His campaign and others.
But the AP, that came out of the Washington Examiner. Okay, so take it with a grain of salt. But then the AP, the AP is refuting that, saying that he did not pay, that that Buttigieg's campaign, it's false that he paid that company, paid the company that created the app. And that, but they said that they did pay Shadow Inc., the company behind the Iowa caucus app, $42,500 in July for text messaging software. Campaign finance records show, and that, you know, the software itself was not related to that developed for the Iowa caucus, but it's still the same company. And to me, I'm thinking it seemed like a surprise to me that Buttigieg did as well as he did. Did anyone sense that or feel that way?
Well, there were some polls in Iowa a month or two ago where he was actually leading, and he was leading both in Iowa and New Hampshire.
Okay.
Well, maybe it's not that unusual.
Just one little sideline observation here. Who the fuck in a political campaign thinks it's a good idea to do business in a Democratic political campaign for president? Thinks it's a good idea to do business with a company after 2016 and all that went with it, after all the dirty tricks and the Russians and all the bullshit? Who thinks it's a good idea to hire a company called Shadow Inc.?
Yeah,
I thought about that.
Anybody? Bueller?
I think the goddess of irony has won that one, Bob. Good
point. Well, just to get back to my apprehension about Mayor Pete, there is a high degree of wonkiness on this guy's part, but I don't see any passion. I mean, he seems to have a ready answer for anything from A to Z.
Yeah, I see a lot of arrogance.
Well, that too. It's like, look at me at how smart I am, knowing all these answers to your serious questions. But I fail to see any measurable passion on the guy's part. You know, it's an icky feeling.
He's like Scott, Peter Scott, Perfect.
People said the same thing about Obama when he was running, about not having the passion.
Well, no, you're right. They did.
So you never know. I'll be a little contrarian here. I'm just looking at this objectively, and I think of all the candidates, Pete is the Democrats' best chance to beat Trump. Don't ask me why. I just have kind of an intuitive feeling that, you know, the guy is a good communicator, and he's not going to take shit from Trump. And, he has Wall Street connections, which might be used against him. But,
right. Rick, he thinks
very quickly on his feet. He's younger. The contrast, young versus old. I mean, he could just like run circles around Trump. you know,
that cockiness and that that confidence could be very helpful.
But then the question becomes, do we want to hang our hat on someone whose only elective office is mayor of a relatively small Indiana town? I mean,
it doesn't matter anymore.
Right, which is exactly
Obama didn't have much experience either.
Yeah, but he was at least a state senator, for God's sakes. He'd won.
Yeah.
That is true.
He'd won something. Yes. As Ron and Raleigh points out, I'm worried about Buttigieg. Does this 37-year-old gay man who couldn't win statewide office and has only received 8,500 votes think he can be president? If he's the nominee, we're done.
8,500 votes.
That's how he won mayor of South Bend, the fourth largest city in Indiana.
And he couldn't
even beat Tom Perez for DNC chair.
He ran for DNC chair. Okay.
He lost a statewide race for treasurer of Talibandiana.
Maybe he's learned from his losses. You never know, Bob.
Well, he's like Peter Perfect, that old book that I read to me as a child. Peter Perfect, you know, and it's kind of on the surface. Mm-hmm. You know, he's hitting all thrusters, you know, except he has this quote-unquote one quote-unquote flaw. You know, he's gay. Mm-hmm. I don't consider that a flaw, but that other people might see that as such. But he kind of, it's like Peter Perfect. He hits all the right, you know, military.
And Darlene, I think, unless I'm mistaken, he lost that treasurer's race before he came out. So what is that? And again, I'll happily vote. I will run smiling to the polls to vote for him if he's the nominee.
Same here.
But I think we have to take the advice of the old knight in the cave in Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade.
Yeah, choose
wisely.
Yeah. And we're able to fuck that up quite easily.
You know who I see in Pete when I look at him?
What's that?
Alfred E. Newman.
Trump is Alfred E. Newman. The way he smiles, that smug smile.
No, but I mean, he looks like Alfred E. Newman to me.
Mm. Well, that's what Trump said, didn't he?
Well, but the funny thing is, I think there's just some people out there who look like Alfred E. Newman. Pete Buttigieg is one, and the other one's George W. Bush, back before his hair turned gray.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
What, me worry?
Right.
Well, I don't know, how's he going to, like, if, you know, how would Pete fare down in South Carolina if he can't really galvanize African
Americans? No, he's going to get buried. What I've said for so long is South Carolina is not is never ever 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 going to give its electoral votes to a Democrat. One.
Right.
Yeah. Two. South Carolina is a Democratic early primary state, not because of its diverse population, but rather because of its non-diverse population. And I'm not talking about the differences between black and white. South Carolina being South Carolina, and you know, Todd could tell me if I'm wrong on this. I think he'll say, no, Bob, you're right. David in South Carolina, Stan, has a hell of a lot more experience, and I think he'll say, no, Bob, you're right. South Carolina is a deeply conservative state. The Democrats are conservative. The Republicans are conservative. The white folks are conservative. The black folks are conservative. And Pete Buttigieg will get buried by, as a Democrat, the Pete Buttigieg will get buried by the African American church in South Carolina for being gay.
And
if I'm wrong, Tracy is free to tell me. And any other members of the African American community in this little community are free to tell me. But I don't think I'm wrong. That's why I'm saying if the Democratic Party wants an early primary state that's got a diverse population, why not Maryland?
Yeah. Yeah.
Why not Illinois?
Well, your point about South Carolina is going to be very interesting. It's going to be very, very interesting to see how Pete does in South Carolina. If he finishes third or fourth, then that would be a very bad sign for his electability, because he may not get the African Americans to turn out in the numbers needed for the Democrats to win.
He already isn't getting them to turn out, Billable.
Well, he's not.
See, he's Pete has a problem down in South Carolina. I'm sorry, Darlene. I didn't mean to jump in on you. By the way, your challenge got met anonymously.
Yes.
We got another $20 beyond it, so that takes us down to $3.35. And I had a lovely note from Kevin in Colorado Springs, who I've been trying to bring on air all night long, but the gizmo is not cooperating. He said, I want to make the following $5 contribution. It'll take a little while after the program to make PayPal do what I want it to do with my accessibility software. But in honor of Darlene's challenge, I want to make a $5 contribution. It's all I can do. But I think it's important to keep Head On and the few other programs like this one on the air. So I'll do my small part on my limited fixed income and hope others listening will follow me in making still more contributions to fulfill and go past Darlene's challenge. Signed, Kevin. Thank you, Kevin. That warms my soul. Thank you. And as to Pete, Lady B with an observation, and she is so often trenchant. Pete Buttigieg, frankly, I think he's a privileged sociopath. That being said, keep that motherfucker by your side. He'll keep secret where you keep the bodies. And P.S., Barack was about as qualified as the arbitrary rules of presidency in white America allowed. He deserved it and did just fine. And he was the first. If I never vote again, I can say I helped make history. And, of course, the key to extending his legacy, one may think it is, the key to extending that legacy is to keep voting. And that's just a daggum fact. Tracy with a note to Lady B. Lady B is right. Dearest sister from another mister, Lady B. I just Googled the Krispy Kreme race, and as I scanned the pictures, all I saw was a sea of white people, which stands to reason that running for 2.5 miles, eating a dozen donuts, and then running another 2.5 miles is white people-ing. And something this fine Nubian goddess will not be participating in. Like Lady B said, I'll be smart and consume my hot Krispy Kreme donut at the end of a race, not before or during. Thank you, Lady B, for helping me keep my black card and not being only banned from the cookout, but never being able to listen to Frankie Beverly again. Love, Tracy.
Well, that's given awesome. The good shape good that Tracy is in, if she does participate in the Krispy Kreme run, one consolation, she will know that she's in good enough shape that the white people will be chasing her. They will be way behind Tracy because she will outrun all of them.
Well, that's the thing. I think maybe there was a mistake. Maybe Ron and Raleigh can chime in on it. But I'm suspecting all those white peopling is probably the people that were at the end of the race who were sitting there dunking their donuts in their coffee and saying, my goodness, yeah, I've got another 2.5 miles to go. Buffy, my God almighty, how are we ever going to finish this thing? Another donut, please, Muffy. And meanwhile, the black folks are just way the fuck, ate their donuts and went on. And they didn't get their picture took.
That's hilarious. I see that combination is so taxing on the heart.
Oh, I think it's designed to see how many people will puke.
Exactly. It's like it's abusive.
It's
so
Roman.
It sounds totally white to me. Totally white. So right. Good on
it
you,
is Roman, Bob.
Lady B.
What name? Purging. That whole thing.
And meanwhile, James in Illinois just saying, the only Democrats who've won statewide, Evan Bayh in Tallahassee. Evan Bayh, son of Birch Bayh, who was beloved by Hoosiers. Bob McDonnell, who squeaked by after his opponent made some kind of comment about victims of rape have a way of stopping impregnation through some magical bullshit. That said, I just don't like it. Wait a minute. This is not... That said, says James, I just don't like the shifty little prick.
I I think that's interesting what Lady B said about Pete Buttigieg being a sociopath. That's a very interesting observation. I got to think about that. She could very well be right.
Well, there is something about his eyes. Look at his eyes next time he's on for any length of time.
It's too smooth. Yeah.
There's just something icky about him that I don't know.
Well, I've heard it said that the presidency attracts sociopaths, you know? Just look who we
are. Well, yeah, and I have long said you have got to have a fundamental psychological or character flaw to want to be president.
Yeah, you have.
I mean, okay, Nixon. Let's back up. Kennedy, John Kennedy, character flaws out the wazoo. Philanderer, yeah. LBJ, I don't know, animal abuse, filthy mind. Nixon, don't even get me started. Jimmy Carter, his character flaw was probably something akin to a messiah complex. The Southern Baptist religion will do that to you. Reagan? Well, Reagan was so fucked up in his head, he thought he was just living a 24/7, 365 movie he was in.
Yeah, the role of a lifetime. You ever read that book, Bob?
Pappy Bush, CIA director. If you've ever been CIA director, you probably should never be president. That might be ought to be a rule.
Bingo.
Bill Clinton.
Bingo.
Big Macs and big girls. That was supposed to be a joke.
We get it.
Goddamn, we don't have enough time. I think if there's a character flaw in Barack Obama, it probably has something to do with having a deep-seated desire to please and assimilate, and the conflict between the conflict over his raising and his childhood and his parentage, the eternal search for the father that will fuck you up, that daddy business, and then Jesus Christ, Donald Trump. Again, this ain't no telethon, so we don't have time. But that fucker is as sick can be. Meanwhile, Shorty in L.A. says, ready answers? They all got it. They all do it. I got your fucking ready. All politics are local, so vote in every election. Shadow was the new name Clinton can't hide. It's not the economy, smart people. It's the ballot, smart people. Fuck Mayor Pete. He's an elitist. My great-nephew, who is in Baghdad, along with other poor and people of color, don't like Pete. He only wins because they haven't found a better Dem. So go out and vote like you're voting for Obama. Just fucking show up at the polls, and we win. Oh, wait. Showing up ain't half the battle. Showing up is the battle. And if it, you know, you can't just sit around and say, I don't know, I'm not excited by any of these candidates. God damn it.
You got to show up with two friends as well. Not
yeah,
just
you show
by
up with two
either.
Friends and you're all excited at the possibility that you're going to be the patriots who saved this country from a goddamn monster.
Yeah.
I mean, if you can't get excited about that, you can't get excited. I mean, you're doing voting to remove Donald Trump from office is patriotism on the order of Cincinnatus of old leaving his farm to go and save Rome, the Republic. It's George Washington rowing and his hearty plucky band rowing across the Delaware on Christmas night. It's people charging up. Up the ridge at Lookout Mountain to save the Republic.
It's storming the shores of Normandy.
It's the Devil Dog Marines in World War I, and that one sergeant said, "Come on, God damn it, you want to live forever?" It's all of that. It's Rosa Parks remaining seated. It's Mother Jones. Leading a group of barely literate minors to stand up on their own hind legs and be and define themselves as human beings worthy of respect by the company. It's all of these things.
Well, it's history hanging on what we do in November. I mean, that's how serious it is. It's the green felt covered poker table with all the chips in the center, and somebody has got to win those chips.
I'm checking out to watch the pageant. It started.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, the debate's on tonight.
Oh, gee, and I forgot to pick up tequila. Damn it!
I'm gonna need it. Yeah, I'm gonna back out too. Yeah, I want to watch.
Well,
that.
Yeah, I mean we've run over time, but I want to thank you, Darlene, thank you, Tracy, and thanks to everybody else. Thank you to our anonymous friend. We will begin Monday at $530, which is a hell of a lot better than beginning Monday at $710. So, and if you're a part of the overnight crew or the over the weekend crew, and you hear this, especially if you've never kicked in to help keep all this going, I mean, it ain't much. We don't charge anybody for access to this program. We don't charge anybody to participate in this program. You can get it any way you want it, any time you want it, and nobody ever gets a bill. But we can't do it on, you know, it won't run on love. And there are bills to pay that are making me sweat bullets. But I do that every month, don't I? Yes, I do. Because that's how you have to do it if you want to do liberal or progressive radio. Because Mike Bloomberg ain't writing no checks. Not here. No way. He writes $50 million checks to people who make $400,000 a year. But not to support the media that this country desperately needs in order to counter the narrative being offered by a bunch of fucking millionaires. So that's my little speech, and I'm sorry for it. But thanks, everybody, for jumping in, and thanks for kicking in. And we'll be back at it on Monday. Thanks to all of you who keep the program on the air, either by your subscriptions or your a la carte contributions, or both. Thanks to you all for sharing your precious finite time on this little blue-green marble hurtling through the universe by participating in this long-running conversation, however you choose so to do. Thanks to our all-volunteer staff. Thanks to Sparky in the chat room and in the old holler tree we sublet from the Keebler Elves. Thanks to our news ninjas. Thank you, Brother Deacon Asa, HeadOn.live. Thank you, John Fox in Australia. Thank you, Ben Birch, WhiteRoseSociety.org. Thanks to the hardest-working, bravest people I know, the men and women of Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. 20 years at the forefront of the struggle for human rights and environmental justice in Appalachia. And always, 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 Gina, it's all for you. Have a great weekend, everybody. Later, y'all.